Mr. Chairman, I am concerned about the situation in the Middle East.
We've given Russia and Israel a great deal of consideration. Russia is, as you probably already know, considering an invasion of Israel in order to obtain a Mediterranean seaport. Well, our policy is to support such a move and supply Israel with the necessary nuclear weapons to fend off such an attack. The mental conditioning of the Israelis is he has nothing to lose and subsequently will attack the Russians before they can get their planes off the ground. Gentlemen, I believe that within a year, two at the most, our one-world government will be a reality. If we continue on our present course, it is my opinion that we could present the devil himself as a world leader, and the people would accept him.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 13th of January 2023. Well, I say ooh because we will be talking later about the Templars, and if you know anything about Friday the 13th, you'll also know it was the morning, the 13th of October, Friday, 1307, that the French king, Philip the Fair, had ordered the Knights Templar, these satanic knights based in the Vatican, to be arrested. And that's why we'll be talking about it, because David Livingstone knows quite a lot about these people and the occult, and so we've got a bit of, I think enlightening stuff about them. And why actually Friday the 13th is a very good omen rather than any kind of bad omen. So it's bad for them, good for us. So, yes, the Friday the 13th of January 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at the port, a Templar port of Bristol, and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, please not Google. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner that gaslights us with its military-grade psyops all the time and navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution. Very topical this week because WEF are meeting at Davos this weekend. Up in the Swiss Alps, making sure, of course, that no protesters can go and protest there because it's absolutely freezing cold. They'd freeze to death if they tried on the mountains of Switzerland. And it's Irish, so that's Irish Republican Labour activist, our guest Martin Summers, hoping also to have local freelance journalist Joe Banks talking about a bit about the Bristol local history at six. So in part one, Dr. Angus Dalgleish, a definite medical theme to begin with, who's an oncologist, talking about the horrible effects of the boosters, apparently exacerbating people who are in remission with cancer, and also Dr. Ryan Cole, and maybe even a little bit of Zev Zelenko. On the theme of the medical theme, live, the ambulance strike. I was chatting to some of the strikers on the picket line this week here in Bristol. And also another, I suppose, live, you'd call it. Well, it isn't live, but it was when I recorded it this week from the Stonehenge protest camp, because just down in Wiltshire, about an hour and a half's drive away from here, at Stonehenge, there's a wonderful little protest camp. And I thought, well, it's a good time to go down and have a chat with them, because in the awful weather in the middle of winter, freezing cold or wet, that's where you find the real protesters, right? Everyone else turns up in the spring when it's all nice and sunny and they can go and party in the woods and whatever. But this time of the year is when you find the stalwarts, and this is exactly what we found down there. Also, I mentioned the World Economic Forum, the meeting in Davos. Who better to explain that than Piers Corbyn, the ubiquitous brother of Jeremy Corbyn, campaigner against the World Economic Forum for decades. And a little look at this thing called the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, 1942. This is when it was published by Walter Funk, who was the economics minister for Adolf Hitler. And Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, Martin, do you know how that translates in modern English?
I'm not sure.
European Economic Community.
Okay.
So an interesting document from 1942, which does seem to signal what happened with the EEC. In part two, A couple of items cancelled from last week, just didn't have time. Hope to God we have time this week, which is the JFK assassination. This fascinating FBI officer, Jack Shelton, who put researchers onto the trail of a guy called James Files, who's still alive, somebody who I am 99.9999% convinced was the guy that actually shot JFK, although apparently the mass media, with all their multi-billions, can't figure this out. Well, you can, and we can, and I can. Jack Shelton's the guy who put everybody onto the, well, not everyone, but a guy who was a private detective, Joe West, onto this the trail of James Files. Anyway, also in memory of Mark Purdy, mentioned that again last week, but I really am going to talk about it this week. I'm going to have a little clip of him, and I'll be playing various clips over the next few weeks of Purdy. Mark Purdy really flagged up the dangers of vaccines in his cattle. He's an organic, was an organic farmer. Back in around about, well, late 1990s with the BSE scandal, the CJD scandal, and he put some very basic points where he just wasn't heard by the press at all. I met him at the Green Party in the late 1990s and recorded an interview with him down at his farm in Devon before he died. BBC did a special on Shamima Begum this week. Interesting to hear. We also got, of course, we've got to have a clip with Prince Harry. Some very interesting stuff Harry was talking about. And then, as I said, Friday the 13th with the Knights Templar. Occult satanic history and its relevance today, if any. But Martin, I think maybe we'll just start by talking about Prince Harry with you. The most important thing I think about all this is we've had loads of stuff about Meghan so far, very little about Harry. As Harry starts to speak, as he did last weekend, the first thing that happens is there's loads of criticism of him talking about Afghanistan. Actually, what he's saying is he felt that the whole thing was a bit of a game. And he's not saying that to brag. He's saying that because what he says, he said on the US comedy show this week, he's saying, well, actually, this is important for people to talk about. That many of the soldiers that went out there, we've had Ben Griffin on this program himself, felt that they were being put like chess pieces being put into a game.
Well, he referred to the people he'd killed as chess pieces removed from the board. And, of course, the Taliban foreign minister has picked up on that and said, well, this is typical of the attitude that these foreigners take towards our people.
But it's not. He's not just saying the one side is a game, is it? He said the whole thing was a bit of a game.
No, the actual quote from him was, I'd taken some chessboard pieces off the board. I'd othered these people. They weren't human. If you thought of them as human, you couldn't kill them. All of which is legitimate for him to say, but the Taliban foreign minister is going to pick him up on this, isn't he?
It's not just the Taliban that's picked him up. The British Army have. They said they don't want him talking about this kind of thing at all.
Well, they don't. I mean, I can't remember the name of the guy, Collins, I think it is, saying we don't put notches on the rifle, blah, blah, blah. No, they don't, but they still go around killing loads of people whether they put notches on the rifle or not. We don't know how many people have been killed by the British Army in Afghanistan. Perhaps we ought to put pressure on to find out.
My instinct with this is, actually, it's brilliant. He's broken a bit of a taboo here. People don't talk about this that come back from Afghanistan, and in fact, they have to bottle it up. Some of them kill themselves.
Well, that's what he said. Don't forget, he's been in therapy, and both he and his brother have made a big deal about mental health. And what he's saying is, I talked about it so that other veterans could feel that they could talk about it. But, of course, it opens a can of worms for the British establishment, because all the British soldiers that died in Afghanistan and all the people they killed was all for nothing, because the Taliban, who were in power when we invaded, are back in power now after 20 years and however many people dead.
Well, when he starts talking about chessmen, I start thinking about game theory. Anyway, Prince Harry talked about the Diana crash as well, a lot about that, saying how he didn't believe it was possible, and also that both he and his brother have still got some serious questions about it, and Afghanistan, as we just mentioned there, and also, of course, drugs he talked about in the interview. I think he opened up quite a lot more in the interview he did with 60 Minutes over in the United States.
Once my mother's coffin actually went into the ground, that was the first time that I actually cried. Yeah, there was never another time.
All through your teenage years, you didn't cry about it?
No.
You didn't believe she was dead?
For a long time, I just refused to accept that she was gone. Part of, you know, she would never do this to us, but also part of maybe this is all part of a plan.
I mean, you really believe that maybe she had just decided to disappear for a time?
For a time, and then that she would call us and we would go and join her.
Yeah. How long did you believe that?
Years. Many, many years. And William and I talked about it as well. He had similar thoughts.
You write in the book, you say, I'd often say it to myself first thing in the morning, maybe this is the day. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is the day that she's going to reappear.
Yeah, hope. I had huge amounts of hope.
He held on to that hope into adulthood. When Harry was 20, he asked to see the police report about the crash that killed his mother, her boyfriend Dodi Al-Fayed, and their driver Henri Paul, while they were being pursued by paparazzi in a Paris tunnel.
The files contained photographs of the crash scene. Why did you want to see it?
Mainly proof. Proof that she was in the car. Proof that she was injured. And proof that the very paparazzi that chased her into the tunnel were the ones that were taking photographs of her lying half dead on the backseat of the car.
You write, I hadn't been aware before this moment, talking about looking at the pictures of the crash scene, that the last thing Mummy saw on this earth was a flashbulb.
Yep.
That's what you saw in the pictures.
Mm-hmm. Well, the pictures showed the reflection of a group of photographers taking photographs through the window, and the reflection of the window was them.
He only saw some of the crash photos. His private secretary and advisor dissuaded him from looking at the rest.
All I saw was the back of my mum's head, slumped on the back seat. There were other more gruesome photographs, but I will be eternally grateful to him for denying me the ability to inflict pain on myself by saying that, because that's the kind of stuff that sticks in your mind forever.
Harry says he believed his mother might still be alive until he was 23 and visited Paris for the first time.
You told your driver, I want to go to the tunnel where my mom died.
I wanted to see whether it was possible, driving at the speed that Henri Paul was driving, that you could lose control of a car and plow into a pillar, killing almost everybody in that car. I need to take this journey. I need to ride the same route.
The same tunnel, the same speed.
All of it.
Your mother was going.
Yep. Because William and I had already been told the event was like a bicycle chain. If you remove one of those chains, the end result would not have happened. And the paparazzi chasing was part of that. But yet, everybody got away with it.
Harry writes he and his brother weren't satisfied with the results of a 2006 investigation by London's Metropolitan Police, concluding Diana's driver, Henri Paul, had been drinking, and the crash was a, quote, tragic accident.
William and I considered reopening the inquest because there were so many gaps and so many holes in it, which just didn't add up and didn't make sense.
Would you still like to do that?
I don't even know if it's an option now, but no, I think, would I like to do that now? It's a hell of a question, Anderson.
Do you feel you have the answers that you need to have about what happened to your mom?
Truth be known, no. I don't think I do. And I don't think my brother does either. I don't think the world does. Do I need any more than I already know? No. I don't think it would change much.
Harry now says it wasn't until he served in combat with the British Army in Afghanistan that he finally found purpose and a sense of normalcy.
My military career saved me in many regards.
How so?
Got me out of the spotlight. From the UK press. I was able to focus on a purpose larger than myself, to be wearing the same uniform as everybody else, to feel normal for the first time in my life, and accomplish some of the biggest challenges that I ever had. I was training to become an Apache helicopter pilot. You don't get a pass for being a prince.
The Apache doesn't give a crap about who you are.
No, there's no prince autopilot button that you can press and just takes you away. I was a really good candidate for the military. I was a young man in my 20s, suffering from shock, but I was now in the front seat of an Apache, shooting it, flying it, monitoring four radios simultaneously, and being there to save and help anybody that was on the ground with a radio, screaming, we need support, we need air support. That was my calling. I felt healing from that, weirdly.
And that multitasking, the brain work of that, that felt good to you?
It felt like I was turning pain into a purpose. I didn't have the awareness at the time that I was living my life in adrenaline. And that was the case from age 12, from the moment that I was told that my mom had died.
You say war didn't begin in Afghanistan. It began in August 1997.
Yeah, the war for me, unknowingly, was when my mom died.
Who were you fighting?
Myself. I had a huge amount of frustration and blame towards the British press for their part in it.
Even at 12, I mean, at that young, you were feeling that toward the British press?
Yeah, I mean, it was obvious to us as kids, the British press's part in our mother's misery. And I had a lot of anger inside of me that, luckily, I never expressed to anybody, but I resorted to drinking heavily because I wanted to numb the feeling, or I wanted to distract myself from whatever I was thinking, and I would, you know, resort to drugs as well.
Harry admits he smoked pot and used cocaine, and writes that in his late 20s, he felt hopeless and lost.
There was this weight on my chest that I felt for so many years, and I was never able to cry. So I was constantly trying to find a way to cry, but even sitting on my sofa and going over as many memories as I could muster up about my mum, and sometimes I watched videos online.
Of your mum?
Of my mum.
Hoping to cry.
Yep.
And you couldn't?
I couldn't.
He sought out help from a therapist for the first time 7 years ago and reveals he's also tried more experimental treatments.
You write in the book about psychedelics, ayahuasca, psilocybin, mushrooms.
You know, I would never recommend people to do this recreationally, but doing it with the right people, if you are suffering from a huge amount of loss, grief, or trauma, then these things have a way of working as a medicine.
They showed you something. What did they show you?
For me, they cleared the windshield, the misery of loss. They cleared away this idea that I had in my head that my mother, that I needed to cry to prove to my mother that I missed her, when in fact, what she wanted was for me to be happy.
So fascinating, I think. Anyway, talking about the use of psychedelics at the end there, Martin, I mean, he goes into quite a lot of depth about his feelings, which is the first time we've ever heard this, really, about his mother dying in the car crash. But I mean, what about this whole idea of taking psychedelics to sort of think your way through stuff? He talks about it as clearing off the windscreen.
Well, I think he's talking about taking them in controlled conditions as a therapy, and that is becoming increasingly, you know, a thing.
It's recognised, isn't it?
It's a recognised
thing. We've covered
it
on this show a couple of times.
And if you think about it, human beings have been using these kind of drugs for thousands, if not millions of years. So it wouldn't be that surprising if there was something in them.
It might be a catharsis for him, actually, in a similar way to his mum had a cathartic moment when she confronted Camilla at a party, and she felt that actually a lot of the trauma kind of dropped from her, you know, after having gone up to Camilla and saying, let's just leave my husband alone. She felt that it wasn't so, she used the word deathly, it wasn't so deathly, because she'd gone and confronted the woman that was the third person in their marriage.
Well, I mean, we all know the outlines of this story, and it's the kind, I mean, obviously it's unique in one way, like all of these things are. But in another way, this is just a family having the sort of problems that families have.
I mean, presumably when he's saying doing psychedelics with the right people, that's Megan. But I mean, that sounds a bit...
Not necessarily. He's saying you shouldn't do this recreationally, which means he's probably done it non-recreationally. Don't forget, he's in California, where this stuff is much more advanced than it is here. And you can legally go and do psychedelics as therapy. So that's probably what he's talking about.
Yeah. And the loss, the grief and the trauma is much less now after all that.
Well, and after killing loads of Afghans.
No, he's not talking about
that.
Well,
no, that's not what we're talking about now. But, I mean, he said the army gave him a sense of purpose and all the rest of it.
What about this whole business about whether... You were saying some really extraordinary things, like he wasn't sure his mother was in the car, even. That's how little he trusted the media and the establishment.
Well, it sounds to me...
He wasn't sure if she was injured or in the car, that she may have been off somewhere saying some amazing stuff, that she would call us and we would go and join her. You know, that's what he thought was going to happen for you know, what he's suggesting here, for a decade or so.
Well, when he was being trained to fly Apache helicopters, you have to do the training if you get captured, and therefore, you know, you are then interrogated, you know, beaten up, and you know, you've got it. And one of the things they were doing, the interrogator was saying to him, apparently I read this, was saying to him, yeah, but your mother was killed probably because Dodi Al-Fayed was her boyfriend at the time, and she was pregnant by Dodie, and therefore suggesting to him that she had been murdered. And
that was a long time afterwards, though, wasn't it?
No, but that was part of, his training in the army.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, what's clear from what he's saying is that he's not going down that road at all.
No, not now. But then he was thinking... What I'm saying about this, Martin, the army did it to him
okay. to see how he would
respond.
You've
just said that, yeah. So what the actual point here is that he was... I mean, from his mum's influence, probably, so mistrusting of the establishment that he thought it was entirely feasible that she'd done a runner, that this was some way of getting away from what she felt was an absolutely horrific situation going on in the UK within the British establishment. They were out gunning for her, weren't they? The whole British establishment at that point, after the separation, after the divorce.
Well, it seems to me that everybody's agreed to dump it on the press, including the BBC guy whose name I've forgotten who interviewed Diana. The famous Panorama
Martin Bashir, yeah. He's been blamed for
this. Yes, he's been blamed for it all. And, of course, Harry joined in with the rest of the royal family in trying to dump it on Martin Bashir, didn't he?
I think actually it was William that did that, not
Yes,
Mark,
I know, but
Harry.
Harry's not spoken
against
that.
But, I mean, in a way, this 60 Minutes interview, I mean, it's not obviously as dramatic as the Diana one, but it's got a similar kind of taboo-breaking feel to it, I think.
It has, and of course, people either like it or loathe it. Lots of people, you know, the front of the Metro this week, was it was in the staff room, was, you know, the public turn against horrible Harry or something similar. So he's...
Well, I don't think they have. I mean,
well, I'm not saying they have. I'm just saying that some people in the press are. I mean, Nigel Farage think that everything's gone downhill with Harry since he wore a Nazi uniform and was a bit of a lad, and then he married that terrible Meghan Markle and so on. There's plenty of people out there who see him as some kind of traitor to Britishness. And, of course, he isn't that. He's entitled to say whatever he wants to say.
Well, he explains that, actually, he and his wife were chased out of Britain. That's what he's basically saying. And he had to go live in the US.
I can see why he might say that.
Hostile environment for Harry and Meghan.
From where I sit, it just seems the whole thing is a soap opera that just doesn't end.
Yeah, but there's real people involved. I mean, you must acknowledge that.
There are real people involved. There's lots of real people who died in ambulances this week, aren't there?
There certainly are. Which is a cue to move on. But we're not going to quite move on yet. The whole idea of the monarchy, I would have thought if Prince Charles plays his cards right, and Harry from California, that actually maybe the monarchy's for the high jump.
Who's for the high jump?
The monarchy.
Well, the monarchy may be removed in this country at some point, but if you actually look at the outpouring of support that the Queen received at around her funeral, and if you look at the opinion polls, apart from in selected parts of the country, like Northern Ireland, it's not likely to be any popular anytime soon. Australia are much further down the road, and Barbados have got rid of the monarchy on the back of the Black Lives Matter protests.
So before we hear from the ambulance drivers, fascinating, I'll put the fuller version of that 60 Minutes interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Before we hear from the ambulance workers, let's have a listen to the teachers who are also in the process of balloting, striking, etc. in various countries around the UK over the inflation, which is sort of outstripping their pay rises. Now, this all, it seems to me, pretty obviously goes back to the oil companies and the gas companies that decided that back in 2021, in the autumn, they were going to put all their prices up. We were told, oh, there's going to be great big price hikes in gas. You know, there were also loads of prices went up at the petrol pumps, as we were told during the party conference season, that apparently there weren't enough drivers because of Brexit to get the petrol. So this is what they do in the third world, these big oil companies, as they starve off the supply and then just put the price up of their fuel. So they're obviously right in charge here. So let's have a listen to the teachers. And this is a woman called Sonia in the beginning. And again, this will be a longer piece up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But she started off from London just explaining what teaching is like now and why it is so important that we listen to teachers. I think she describes it here as that this is basically teachers are our national childcare. If you don't listen to them, then the kids are going to suffer.
I would like to champion teachers. I don't think enough from the media is spoken about the good work and the recognition for teachers.
Okay.
They are the nation's childcare. Without teachers, there are no nurses, there are no bus drivers, there are no rail workers, there's no bidet.
Right.
And that's part of the job. That's absolutely fine. I was a secondary school teacher, two degrees, spent 8 years studying, and you can't get into the job, and wow, you are sucker punched. I was spending around £20 to £30 a month purchasing pens and equipment, and this is on a monthly basis, and if you spoke to most teachers, many do this.
Is that because there isn't enough stuff in the school?
It's a couple of things. There's not enough equipment in the school. You can have a budget of about £1,000 or £1,500 for a department of 6 to 10 teachers. That's for the year. That's all your photocopying, that's all your ordering books, textbooks, exercise books, that's all your pens.
Yeah.
So there isn't enough. Children aren't coming to school with pens. Sometimes wonderful parents out there, wonderful, beautiful people out there. However, there's some parents who don't parent. They're not checking their children have their equipment. So I was purchasing £20 to £30 worth of pens just to make sure the lessons were
done. Just to give to the kids?
Just to give to the kids.
Well, what percentage would you say of any class of, say, 30 people, how many of those kids would you say didn't have a pen?
Possibly around 10.
Right.
So that's
a lot, isn't it?
That's a third. It is a lot, and that's a lot of money.
I mean, when I went to school, heaven forbid you turn up without a pen.
Oh, shut up.
But nobody would have given. But nobody would have given me a pen if I didn't have one. I'd probably been made to sit in the corner.
No. I mean, to get the pen back, because the children often forget. It's not a deliberate thing. They'll go off, or they'll take it for their next lessons because they don't have a pen all day.
Right.
So they've got to go to the next lesson. I sometimes take a shoe, and I have to have a whole row of shoes at the front of my classroom to say I want my pen back.
So you get it back.
You get it back. I'm also paying for photocopying to be done as well.
So Sonia goes on there to talk about having to go down the road to do photocopying because it's cheaper for her personally to do it than take it into the school office where she gets personally charged for the photocopying she does nowadays for the kids, which just sounds appalling. It's the sort of thing that happened at the BBC when I was there in 1990 when they brought in this thing called producer choice where everything you do has got to be costed even though you're part of a massive corporation just to... So, for example, to get a sports reporter on, you have to then pay for that. Well, actually, most of the BBC, we just ignored the thing. But, I mean, obviously, that would be. There are some heads that would do the same, Martin, aren't they? Just say, well, here's some pens, you know, get on with the job, because we want you to be able to do the job. And here's a photocopier, just use it as much as you need. Would the heads be able to say that today?
The fundamental underfunding in schools is to do with austerity since 2008. And, of course, it's been underfunded for years, but after 2008, it became, you know, the money's just not there because we bailed the banks out, we invaded Afghanistan, Iraq and Libya, and that's where the money went.
And of course, now Ukraine. So the other thing she was talking about was saying that she turned up at school for years. At 6 a.m, because some of the parents who had jobs that started early just simply dropped the kids off at school, and the kids were expected to twiddle their thumbs waiting in the bike sheds for 2 or 3 hours until school started. And so what the head suggested, this is in a big secondary school, was that they actually bring the kids in and have a kind of breakfast club thing. So she ran that in her spare time.
Well, breakfast clubs are a key thing. Except if you think about it, lots of people have to go out to work quite early, and schools don't start till about 8:30 in terms of teaching. A lot of this just simply comes down, as with the health service, to lack of money. And there's plenty of money. There is a magic money tree. The money that we have got, we reduce the taxes on the wealthy, so they don't have to pay as many taxes, and the money was spent on PPE that we didn't need companies connected to the government, and, of course, the austerity of Osborne, which lost the country its AAA credit rating. This can't be stressed enough. Not only was it destructive, it was also pointless because the economy went down the drain as a result of austerity, and then they had to stop because the other alternative was to run it into the floor.
The lords of chaos. They don't care. And actually, one of the first things that every teacher should write up on the blackboard in the morning when they turn up at school is the rich pay no tax, Martin.
Well, they could do that, but they might end up out of a job, especially if they're working in an academy school, where, of course, the academy school system means that you've got no appeal beyond the academy. There used to be, schools used to be run by local authorities, and unions had some power and so on.
Well, get yourself a job in a state school, a proper state school, not in a private.
Well, it's very difficult, because the state system has been fragmented quite deliberately and turned into a dog's breakfast.
Well, you've gone back to school after Christmas. How's things at your school?
Well, we're getting on with what we have to do. I'm a fairly lowly cog in the structure. And, of course, I've joined the NEU. I haven't had a ballot paper. I was hoping that I would join in time to get a ballot paper, because as a support worker, I'm now allowed to join the NEU. But I think it's pretty clear that teachers I've spoken to, including my family, have definitely voted to strike. And there will be school strikes on top of all the other strikes.
Deliberate, certainly seems to me. Anyway, over to the railways. And fascinating, great fun, bit of fun today. Okay, so that was on the Mike Graham Show, that sort of clip with Sonia. And like I said, I'll put a link up to the full interview on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. If you want to hear more from her, she's absolutely fascinating, brilliant teacher. Mick Lynch, the General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, was being grilled by an MP's committee today. And he certainly gives as good as he gets.
When we had the session with your deputy and Mr. Shoveler earlier, that 8% pay offer had just been made. Do you not think it would have been reasonable at least to put it to your members and just determine whether they were willing to accept that, or if, as you say, they wouldn't, then you've got your proof and you've got your negotiating arm?
Well, we did put it to our members through their elected reps. I mean, that's what you do in the chamber.
Isn't that what you do
in this chamber every day? Are you going to put the Chancellor's budget to a referendum?
Well, you're
going to put it to elected reps.
No, we don't.
And they'll make the decision.
No, not at all. We all actually have our vote. That's the whole point. We don't give it up to anyone else.
Do our reps when we have a mass meeting.
No, but what about all of your members?
Your constituents? Will they vote on the budget?
Let
their elected representatives
the next election?
Well, obviously, if we work on every basis like that, then we'll be in Switzerland, where the railways may work.
Exactly the same situation in the union. We've got multiple companies. We deal with 400 companies in the course of a year. Unite must deal with 4,000 or 5,000, for all I know. We'd be running around running referendums on a non-stop basis.
Following your logic, why do you bother putting anything to the members at all then?
Because we get to a final position that may be at the point of either agreement or impasse, and we go to them for their endorsement. I mean, you didn't put every version of the European treaty to the country.
We tried it once.
Exactly.
Does the RMT accept that in order to secure everybody's jobs within the railways, something does need to fundamentally change in terms of making the railways attractive to people to buy tickets again, and having uncertainty over whether the train will be running in the first place is equally driving people away from the railways and back into their cars or coaches or whatever it may be?
I think you're absolutely right. The railway does need fundamental change, but it's not the one that the railway companies are seeking. We need a railway that runs in the interests of the people, in the interests of the economy and the environment, not in the interests of First Group and others who are subject to private equity takeovers because they're so attractive. The changes they wish to make to strip out wages and conditions are so that they can make increased profits going forward, and they're doing that at the behest of the Secretary of State and the previous incumbent in that job on an ideological basis. So what we need is lower fares. We need an incentivisation for people to get out of their cars and onto the railway. They won't do that with the current fare structure and the current industry structure, and they won't do that with the industry structure that's proposed under the Shapps White Paper for Great British Rail, because you'll keep the corrupt system of railway privatisation where there is no risk, where these people have got a one-way ticket to profit, as you've just heard, where even if they score zero on customer satisfaction and are unable to run the trains at all when there's no industrial action because they've declared war on the staff and on the passenger, they will make profit no matter what happens, because that's the structure that's been put in place. So we need fundamental change, yes. We don't need to attack the staff.
What do you believe was the average profit margin for a railway operator pre-pandemic?
It's quite low, but there's no risk. There's no risk to them at the moment.
Do you accept the 2% figure?
It's probably 2%, but if there's billions of pounds in circulation, that is quite a comfortable living. If I was getting 2% of all railway income, I'd be doing quite well. And so Normally businesses have to put capital at risk, don't they? Yeah. That's why they justify their profit. Well, this is a cartel of people that are working with the government to produce surpluses at no risk to themselves. Yeah. And no matter what their reputation is in this industry, the government will keep paying them. That is ridiculous, and I might put it, a corrupt system, because there's no incentive for them to make any change. The TOCs have taken £3.5 billion worth of profit out of the railway since privatisation. They haven't done anything for us because they've got no risk.
When they've had risk, they've handed back the keys.
So that's the RMT General Secretary. Hooray for Mick Lynch. Martin, he's making some really good points there. The only thing I wished he had talked about was our thing we had with the ASLEF rep about Roscoe's before Christmas, where the RMT themselves have said that these companies basically don't do anything. They just supply the trains. They have made something like 1.2 billion over just a few years that they've handed over to their shareholders. So just from the fact that they own the trains and they lease them to the train operating companies, there's vast amounts of money going to the train operating companies and to these Roscoe's rolling stock companies. And as he's pointed out, maybe the most important point he made there was that even if they don't run trains, they still turn a profit.
Well, that's right. There's more subsidy to the railways now than under nationalisation. And you do have to subsidise railways because a lot of commuter trains are not, they don't make a profit. Commuter lines don't make a profit because they're only used fully twice a day and there's a massive infrastructural investment in them. Other countries have recognised this a long time ago, and they if you're going to subsidise something, there is no case for it to be in the private sector whatsoever, is there? The private sector is supposed to be for making profit, inventing a better widget. If you've got to subsidise it...
Oil, gas?
Oil and gas should be in the public sector, shouldn't they?
Yeah, well, they're being subsidised, aren't they? People are getting all this extra money to buy their gas.
Indeed. And what Mick Lynch is putting his finger on there is that the model of the economy pursued in this country since 1979 is fundamentally wrong. And I've known that for years and years and years. Gradually, the public beginning to wake up. We should never have privatised the railways. We should never have privatised British Gas. We should never have privatised lots of things. But we did. And then, of course, we say, well, it's privatised now and we've got to run it like it is. No, we haven't. We need fundamental change. And this is exactly the offer that Jeremy Corbyn was making in 2019. But of course, the media and everybody else said, no, that's far too radical. All he was really saying is, why don't we go back to doing what we used to do in the 1960s? Which was a perfectly good way to run it.
Well, one of the mad things about all of this is the horrific price of housing. That doesn't means that, you know, so much of the wages of all these key workers, teachers, railway workers, ambulance staff, nurses, is just going in rent, Martin. What on earth
or
is going
on? Mortgage payments.
Well, rent or mortgages, yeah. And we've just heard, of course, that mortgages are going up as well as rent.
Well, the whole purpose of having a council house building programme, and it was Harold Macmillan, the Conservative Prime Minister, who built most council houses during his tenure in office, was to keep the price of housing down, especially for poorer people. You could have a situation like in Cuba, where everybody gets paid the same, or in Japan, where wages are much higher compared to top salaries. But in this country, we have a free market economy where some people, at least a third of the population, cannot afford decent housing. That's why you have to subsidise it. And once you've subsidised it, you can then produce goods which are competitive on the international market.
You talk about council housing. What is Bristol City Council doing about these rack-renting landlords? Well, the answer is a very postmodern response. What they're doing is they're having votes. They had a vote this week, which was led by Labour's housing lead on the cabinet under the Blairite Mayor Marvin Rees, called his name's Tom Renard, and he was the bloke that Acorn, who represents a lot of tenants in the city, actually went into City Hall and closed down a meeting of the Housing Consultation Board of some sort, which was a bunch of appointees, because even though it was set up after, well, Tom Renard from Acorn, who, when he was actually part of Acorn, Acorn were not invited and they're not part of it or anything. The other thing which I found out is that Tom has never been along to a single meeting of the most recent Housing Management Board, Martin. So this guy, Tom Renard, he's a Labour councillor, and we're about to hear from him about rent caps now. But the fact of the matter is, the council can have as many votes as it wants on rent caps. They would be the, well, one of the things they don't like talking about, but it's an absolute fact, is that they cannot impose rent caps. So in a way, this is a, what they're doing is for publicity purposes. What they don't tell you at the end, of the vote is, oh, well, well, we don't want, we want to impose rent caps, but actually we can't. We're not allowed to.
Well, that's a fundamental problem with all of this agitation about local government, and we need changes in local government, and local government's got to pull its socks up and all that. So if you've had a 60% cut in your budget, as Bristol City Council and many other councils across the country have had, you can't do a lot of things.
So they're doing they're doing window dressing instead, and they're saying, we're going to have a vote about it, but we can't do anything, sorry.
Yes, that's window dressing. What they ought to be saying, as I've said before on this show many times, is what local Labour councillors should be doing to turn around to people and say, we can't do much about this until we've turfed the Tories out of Westminster. And that's got to be the goal. Everything else is just talk.
So let's have a listen to this report from ITV West this week about this rent cap vote. And Tom Renhard, you can actually hear him here, the Labour lead on housing, who doesn't do anything.
The single mum Laura fears time for 14-month-old Ren to play in this living room is running out. The pair may lose their house after being issued with an eviction notice which requires them to leave by tomorrow. And Laura says as much as she's tried to find somewhere else they can call home, the city is largely unaffordable.
The private rental market at the moment is ridiculous. It's super expensive. I can't afford it by myself as a single mum. I have to get universal credit because I'm paying over £1,000 rent here, and then bills on top, and then obviously personal stuff on top of that. A loan with universal credit, it's just not enough to cover everything.
Despite finishing maternity leave early and at one stage working two jobs, the 27-year-old says she's unable to find anywhere to live. Laura says the experience of battling rising rates has left her feeling powerless.
It makes me feel quite upset, because obviously I'm trying my hardest to work and be a parent and trying to find a house, and just this is his first home, and I know that he's not going to remember it. We've made lots of memories over the past year and a half, but he's innocent throughout all of this, and it seems a shame that he has to be put through it too with me.
Laura and Ren aren't alone in being priced out of Bristol. According to the council, almost a third of all homes in the city are privately rented, and the cost of renting has also risen by 50% in the last decade. And it's that issue the council is tackling today. They're calling on the government for permission to implement rent controls.
We know it's become increasingly unaffordable to rent in Bristol. It's becoming really challenging. It's affecting everyone. It's affecting hospitality workers. It's affecting nurses. It's affecting teachers. It's affecting people that work in social care. So the problem for us is that things are so bad now in Bristol that we need to be able to take action.
Capping rental prices isn't a power that the council currently has. But people we spoke to outside City Hall today believe it will be positive for the community.
Yeah, anything that will bring the rents down and for people to have homes to live in, which I think is a right.
Yeah, I would definitely support a cap.
The rents they're charging are astronomical and it's got out of control, so yeah, big fan of capping.
For tenants like Laura and Ren, today's vote may not provide immediate help. But with a range of measures designed to tackle unaffordable rates, it's hoped the key to unlocking a brighter future may not be far away. Will Charlie, ITV News, Bristol.
So Tom Renard there, Martin, saying, well, we're going to ask central government, please can we do this? Of course, central government's going to say no. The fact of the matter is that as mortgage rates go up, so the buy-to-let landlords are going to start putting the rent up. Well, of course, they already have.
They have. And also, of course, one of the problems with rent caps is that they may then decide to just get out of the market altogether and boot everybody out, which is why you need a solid council housing sector, which we should have not got rid of in the first place. But hey, what the problem is in this country, we've got used to not even third rate, it's fourth rate policies, and then we can't change any of those, so we then have to work within the narrow framework that's been created by the Tory press and the right wing establishment in the country. But of course, it's absolutely insane. Undermines the economic efficiency of the country. Rents in Germany and house prices haven't changed in 40 years. people don't worry about it. I mean, I remember a friend of mine who's, who went over to Germany, and he said to the Germans, what do you do about homelessness? And they said, well, we just house people. What do you do? And we've just got used to a completely dysfunctional setup in this country. And there's still plenty of Tory voting homeowners who've made loads of capital gains over the last decade and a half who think it's wonderful because it's just money for old white for them.
I do hope we have time to hear from Scott Ritter, former US Marine Corps intelligence officer, because the same has been noted by him and others when he talked this week to a guy called Garland Nixon. They were talking, discussing, well, certainly we're fighting, you know, pouring all this money into Ukraine, Martin, and yet they've got tent cities over in the States, people living in cars and things like that. And they've got a car because they've got a job. They can afford to run a car. They just can't get a deposit. They can't get into a house because it's just too expensive.
Well, this the whole drive of the neoliberal project is to allow rent seeking rather than investment in productive activity.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to Scott now and this chap talking about this very subject.
Strategy of victory for Ukraine, that is real. I'm not, I mean, yes, there's talking heads out there that say, Ukraine will win. That's not a strategy. Tell me how they're going to do it. Tell me exactly, step by step. You see, I can do the opposite. I can sit here and tell you how I think Russia is going to win. And it's logic, it's fact-based, etc. No one could do the same thing for Ukraine. No one can sit there and, you know, build capability where nothing, where the components don't exist. And yet we're going to pour all this money, literally waste this money. This is money gone forever. And meanwhile, back here in America, Americans, our fellow citizens, are suffering, as you showed. So, yeah, I think there's a disconnect here. Somehow we got to find a way to get the American people to wake up to what's going on at home and figure out that the best national security our country can have begins with good infrastructure, jobs, healthcare, education, homes. You know, criticize Russia all you want. I'll say this, it's a constitutional right to have a home in Russia.
Wow.
So that's the conclusion of that discussion about the war with Scott Ritter, constitutional right to have a home in Russia.
Well, if you think about it, it's obvious in Russia, where it gets very, very cold in the winter, that if people don't have anywhere to live, they're simply going to die. And the Russia inherited some aspects of the Soviet setup, and the idea that people could be deprived of a home is just unthinkable to them.
It's the same as in Scandinavia, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where it gets so cold, what on earth are you going to do? You're going to chuck people out on the streets? When we were in Canada over in Vancouver, it was quite interesting there because there was loads of homeless there, but that's because it's the warmest city in Canada, and all of the homeless from other parts of Canada were brought to Vancouver to be looked after. They were outside during the summer, but in the winter they were put in dorms.
Yeah, but I mean, the homelessness is a symptom of the failure of the whole policy that's being
pursued.
Well,
Tony Benn used to say that this was actually quite useful for the Tories because it's good that people see homeless people because it reminds them what might happen to them.
Absolutely.
If they don't knuckle down.
Absolutely. Gore Vidal pointed out that people can't enjoy their ill-gotten gains unless they see the poor are punished and seen to be punished. And that wasn't the view in this country, but of course we imported this US view of how society should be organised, and bit by bit that's how British society has become organised.
Okay, well, the last thing we want is for all of our key workers to be driven down to this position where they can't afford to pay the bills, they can't afford to pay the rent, they can't afford to pay the mortgage, they're getting evicted, that sort of thing. And so I thought it was great. As I spotted one of these pickets this week to have a chat to some of the striking ambulance workers.
Hi, I'm a paramedic. We're here because we're seriously concerned about the neglect of the NHS at the moment. Patients are suffering, we're suffering. We really, really need to make some changes, and at the moment we feel like the only way that we can get any attention to this issue is to stand up and strike at the moment.
A lot of the press is saying this is about pay, but you're suggesting maybe it's much more to it than that.
pay is an aspect. Obviously, with the problem we have is recruitment and retention. A lot of people are burnt out in the ambulance service, and the more people that leave, the more pressure it puts on existing staff, and it's just a vicious circle. So yes, we do want fair increases our pay with inflation, but we also see this as a big systemic neglect over the last 12 years of the NHS. It's a political choice, and we need to draw attention to this. We need to stand up for what we think.
How long have you been doing this job?
I've been in the ambulance service since 2008. And I've seen the deterioration in the standard of care that our patients are getting, not through our own fault, but by the fact that the NHS is under this huge pressure, massive increase in waiting times, massive increase in waiting times for ambulances. People are suffering because of it, and it's never been as bad as it has been over the last probably 18 months now.
Give us an experience that you've had that's really made you question whether you're actually able to do your job or not.
I can think of weekly experiences of arriving on scene to patients who have been waiting for way longer than they need to be waiting. I'm talking about people having heart attacks, who've been waiting over an hour for an ambulance and seriously suffering for it. We're desperately sorry for them, and feeling desperately sorry for them, and trying to do our job, knowing that it's already been hindered before we've even arrived on scene. I've had colleagues crying because they've been working up in control and seeing 750 jobs outstanding who need an ambulance and aren't getting one, including a mother of a three-year-old child in cardiac arrest. It is extremely heartbreaking, and it makes me quite emotional, really.
Some saying that this is just the Tories, and actually the Conservatives for decades have wanted to bring an end to the National Health Service.
Yeah, I mean, if they manage to pull the wool over the public's eyes and make this seem like a situation that's impossible to get out of, maybe people will think the only way is to go down the privatisation route. But actually, it's a political choice to underfund the NHS, and that we do have the means to pay for it. And actually, if we look at all of the world's health services, we pay the least, and we're used to get a great service until we've been slowly undermined. And I think it's worth the money, and we need to invest if we want to have a world-class health service again.
If you were in charge, $64,000 question, what quick tweaks? I mean, obviously money is needed, but what would you be doing if someone put you on the chief executive of the NHS's desk? You know, this problem can be fixed, we know it can be fixed. What would you do?
I think obviously there needs to be a plan for improving investment, but I do think that we need to be able to support people coming out of hospitals through any emergency measures that we can, really, so that we can get people out of stuck bed blocking in hospitals, getting them home with the support and care they need, so that then when people are ill, they can then get into the hospital where they need to go. And so almost to the point of where you know, we're putting so much we're pulling the army and military into the ambulance service right now, but actually can we make emergency measures to support people coming out of hospitals in the short term? But obviously long term, it's just like, it's the investment in the social care services that will allow people to get out of hospital and recover, so that the new sick people can get in and get the treatment they need, really.
That's simple, actually. It's just that people cannot go into the hospitals because of the bed blocking.
I mean, it's one of the major things. It's not that simple. But it's one of the major problems. Obviously I'm not in a position to be able to, in my role as a paramedic, to be able to kind of find all the answers, but I do know that that is one of the big problems.
An operation like yours really relies on good morale, people working well together, feeling that they've joined a job which is a public service job they want to do. How is morale, and what can be done to make it better?
morale is not good at the moment in any aspect, part of the NHS, but it's not good in the ambulance service at the moment. And it's absolutely vital. People come into this job because they want to help people, but if they are burnt out, if they are emotionally fatigued, it becomes very, very challenging to do this job. It's a very intense job, and you need to be in good physical and mental health at the moment. It's very hard to be in that position, and so yeah, morale has seriously affected. But it's nice to be here together now, sort of sense of camaraderie, really, to be together and fighting to try and make some improvements, really, or get the attention to make some improvements.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
So, from the streets of Lawrence Hill here in Bristol, was one of the ambulance workers, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's put his finger on most of the problems, hasn't he?
A paramedic.
Yeah, I mean, you could hear people tooting in their cars as they went past the picket line, which is good to
even,
hear.
Even an ambulance going by, which apparently they were saying were being driven by soldiers on Wednesday. But he's also saying it's a vicious circle. What's happening is the massive overload of their job is leading to people leaving the service, which means the overload increases. Also talking about 750 jobs, including heart attacks, sitting there waiting when he arrives on shift.
Yeah, well, the fundamental problem is the policy pursued since the Tories took power the last time. But New Labour, for all of its faults, recognised that you have to spend more money on the health service year on year because the population's ageing and the kind of treatments that are available continually improve. Now, most other countries recognise that you've got to carry on increasing healthcare spending. Now, people shouldn't go, gosh, that's terrible, we can't just carry on increasing healthcare spending. Health is your wealth. Health is the most important thing. And if some people have to be taxed more so that they can't go on skiing holidays so that other people can get leukemia treatment, well, so be it.
Well, the Health Secretary Stephen Barclay and Rishi Sunak this week announced that 3,000 beds in care homes are going to be funded so people can be moved out of hospital. This will stop some of the bed blocking.
Yes, but the care homes are all privatised. There's a very good article by George Monbiot, remember him, in The Guardian this week, pointing out that...
He does do some good articles.
This is a good one.
That's part of the cover.
One of the things they're doing, and the Tories have passed this week, and people can check his article, is that they've decided to bring... They're chucking public money at private hospitals who do hardly any work. And, of course, they don't train any nurses and doctors. So, step by step, you see, this is shock doctrine capitalism. As the National Health Service goes down the drain, and we had the guys on that radio talk last week that we covered, they're talking about, well, we're going to have to reform the health service. Now, we don't have to reform the health service, we just have to do it properly. And that includes spending money on social care, which probably means increasing taxes on people who've made money out of house prices. Why not? So that social care can be covered for everybody.
Well,
in Scotland, you don't have to pay for social care. In England, you do.
The subject of health, the whole COVID vaccine thing hasn't been going too well, folks, has it? Andrew Bridgen, who we covered extensively on our pre-Christmas programme, he has been booted out for comparing. What do you think, first of all, about him comparing this? Well, he wasn't comparing it to the Holocaust. He said he believed that the whole vaccine, mRNA vaccine rollout, was the worst. I want to get the exact words up. Anyway, it was the worst mass murder since the Holocaust.
Well, it sounds a bit exaggerated, doesn't it, Tony? To say
you
the
think
least.
He should be suspended for what? Well, he's been suspended for anti-Semitism.
Well. It's a matter for the Conservative Party who they allow to represent them.
Yeah.
But I think the politics of this are that one of the few benefits of Brexit, according to the mass media, is the vaccine rollout.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's
therefore,
Bridgen is nothing to do with that.
No, Bridgen was a very strong pro-Brexiter. Listen, Tony.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yes. So you want to hear about this? The politics of this inside the Conservative Party are this, and within the Conservative press. The vaccine rollout is actually one of the few things this Tory government can point to which they've succeeded at. So they certainly don't want people coming along saying vaccines are dangerous.
They've succeeded in killing people.
Well, that may be so, Tony, but that undermines the Tories' only pitch to the British people.
The thing is, at least there's a spread of opinion within the Tory party. Let's have a listen to Andrew Bridgen.
And it's hard to believe, ladies and gentlemen, that 100 years ago we ran a quarter of the globe from Westminster. Mr. Speaker, I will bring my remarks to a conclusion, but it is clear to me, and it will be clear to the public, that to the fag end of your tenure in that chair, you are defending the indefensible and your very close relationship with the honourable member in question.
So, Andrew Bridgen, that was just almost a kind of random clip, so at least you hopefully will recognise his voice. But he was, one of the things, main things he was talking about in his speech before Christmas was this whole idea of willful blindness. Now, this is something which I think we could probably apply to Afghanistan, to Ukraine, to the Nazis in Ukraine. There seems to be almost a growing problem where our press and many of our politicians have willful blindness.
Well, there's always going to be a problem of groupthink, and of course that's the kind of thing
he's
talking
kind of
about.
Taking it one stage on from that. He's saying, well, it's not just that people are just following everybody else, but they're actually deliberately not seeing things.
Well, he's deliberately not seeing that 9/11 was an inside job.
Is he?
No, he hasn't mentioned anything about 9/11,
Tony. Yes, but who's asked him about 9/11, have you?
I'm asking him about
9/11.
You're
just changing
the subject. If
we're
talking about willful blindness, why is it only willful blindness about vaccines?
He's talking about willful blindness about all sorts of things.
Yes, but he didn't talk about the most fundamental things.
Well, not according to you, anyway.
That's willful blindness by him.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, it's not necessarily.
No, it is, Tony, I'm afraid. If we're going to talk about willful blindness, the willful blindness is about the deep state in the West.
I'm trying to remember what he did talk about
I think that COVID itself is a biological warfare agent. Willful blindness by everybody to ignore that.
Martin, just hang on a minute, yeah? Because he's talking about willful blindness in the medical profession. Ah. So, for example, with things like thalidomide.
No, he didn't talk
about... Yes, he did.
He talked about willful blindness in relation to all sorts of different things.
No, he's talking about specifically about COVID in a speech about COVID and about the vaccines, and I think he deserves a big pat on the back for that. Anyway, I mean, you know, it's just because the Labour Party haven't actually opposed on any of this vaccine stuff, that's why you're getting so irate, I think. So let's have a listen to his speech where he made a statement, and you can have your say after he's had his say. You've just been shouting for the last couple of minutes, and let's have a listen to Andrew Bridgen's statement that he made after he was suspended from the House. In other words, being accused,
suspended from the Tory Party.
He was suspended from the House for something else. Before Christmas, you're right.
Yes, he was suspended from the House because
for
of...
For 3 days.
For lobbying.
Now he's been suspended from the Tory Party.
He's still an MP, but he's suspended from the Tory Party over his comparing vaccines to the Holocaust.
And this is what he has to say about it all.
I'm disappointed that the Chief Whip, Simon Hart, with the support of the Prime Minister, has chosen to suspend me as a member of the Conservative Parliamentary Party. My tweet of 11th of January was in no way anti-Semitic. Indeed, it alluded to the Holocaust being the most heinous crime against humanity in living memory. Of course, if anyone is genuinely offended by my use of such imagery, then I apologise for any offence caused. I wholeheartedly refute any suggestions that I am racist, and currently I'm speaking to a legal team who will commence action against those who've led the calls suggesting that I am. Indeed, the Israeli doctor I quoted in my tweet has stated that there was nothing at all anti-Semitic about the statement. The fact that I have been suspended over this matter says much about the current state of our democracy, the right to free speech, and the apparent suspension of the scientific method of analysis of medicines being administered to billions of people. As I've consistently maintained, there are very reasonable questions to be asked about the safety and effectiveness of the experimental mRNA vaccines and the risks and benefits of these treatments. There are reasonable questions to ask of a government that is considering extending the use of these experimental vaccines to children as young as 6 months of age. These, ladies and gentlemen, are babies. There are reasonable questions about the side effects of mRNA vaccines, especially when we know categorically that the current risk of harm to most of the population, and especially young people, from COVID-19 is minuscule. We have a government who indemnifies vaccine manufacturers from claims against the harms caused by their products, and a government who, it appears, actively look to remove MPs who raise questions about those harms. I was saddened to hear yesterday of my suspension. But I'm not downhearted. I've received huge support from ordinary people, medical workers who are too intimidated to speak out, and of course from those who've experienced vaccine harms themselves or to a loved one. Hopefully, the media interest around my suspension will finally get the issue of vaccine harms into the media, who have been so reluctant to cover this issue for so long, an issue which is clearly of huge and growing concern to many people across the globe. Reasonable questions about the safety and effectiveness of mRNA vaccines must continue to be asked, and I will continue to ask them. If I cannot do that as a Conservative Member of Parliament, then so be it. Highlighting these important questions, questions about life, death, serious injury, must override party loyalty. I owe that not only to my constituents in northwest Leicestershire, but also to the wider British public, and especially to our children and young people, who are the very future of our great nation. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Well, I won't be putting a complete version of that up on our show page, because it was a complete, mercifully short, about 3 minutes. Martin is really saying that these matters are far more important than party loyalty, and the idea that his party's now turned on him, he's kind of shrugging his shoulders and saying, well, so be it.
Well, I think there are legitimate questions to be asked about vaccines, but he's been suspended for comparing the vaccine rollout to the Holocaust. And that's what he's being put on trial for by the Conservative Party.
He's saying it's the worst crime against humanity since the Holocaust.
I would argue that the creation of COVID-19 as a bioweapon by the deep state in the US and then and killed millions of people in China is probably quite
a lot of people. Agree with him, but does that mean he should, you know, surely, I mean, shouldn't his statements be covered by some sort of parliamentary privilege? So he's allowed to say things.
Well, his statements are covered by parliamentary privilege.
It's just the Tories don't like
it. He is still a member of Parliament, and he cannot be removed as a member of Parliament except through an election, but he cannot.
Well, there may be one of those recall elections.
Yes, there might be a recall election if that's possible.
That would be interesting.
But
maybe that's why.
At the moment,
yeah.
He is suspended
maybe
from the Conservative
done it,
Party.
Is what I'm
which
saying.
Is a matter for the
maybe
Conservative
Party. Maybe that's
why
he's done it, to see if his constituents would back him in a recall election.
Well, I mean, if he's that serious about it, he could call for such a recall election. He can call for one. But I think he's probably going to find that if he stands in an election at the moment, he's one of the recently elected Tories who's probably got, I don't know what his majority is, but it's probably not enough, given the current opinion polls. He's probably going to be out, which is one of the reasons possibly why he's being so forward about this, because he's got no chance of winning the next election anyway.
Well, we shall see. Well, it gives him a good chance for a bit of freedom of speech, which he certainly used. And on the similar subject, Dr. Angus Dalgleish, this week, has been talking about the COVID jabs. He is a oncology doctor, a cancer doctor, causing actually relapses amongst some of his patients. Anyway, let's not. This to me is a complicated issue, but I think we need to let Dr. Angus Dalgleish tell us about it himself. This is his interview with Richard Tice on Talk TV and Talk Radio on Sunday.
I'm Angus Dalgleish. I'm a professor of oncology at St George's, a consultant medical oncologist, and I have started to notice that several of my patients with melanoma who've been stable, stage 4 disease, they've had very good immunotherapy or other treatments, and I've been reviewing them from 5 to 20 years. I've noticed that I have now over 6, possibly 7, even an 8th yesterday, who've clearly relapsed following the booster vaccine. At first, we didn't put the two together. But when patients said, I felt awful since the vaccine, I've just been drained, they described symptoms of like a long COVID. And the next thing we know, 2-3 weeks, couple of months later, they've got clear evidence of relapse. And these relapses are quite aggressive. They're not a gentle relapse. They're relapses that are requiring systemic therapy as opposed to a little nodule that requires surgical excision. But it's not just this. I'm now very much aware in my own circle of many people who are having, they haven't got melanoma, but they've never had anything before, but they've got lumps and bumps and they're not feeling well. And two people I've interviewed at great length, they all put it down to feeling awful after their booster. They were fine with the first two vaccines, or just had shivers, flu, etc. But they've described being very tired, very fatigued, wanted to stay in bed. And this has dragged on to the point where they've gone to the doctor and they've had blood counts and investigations. And I now know seven of them. Two of them have leukemias and the others have lymphomas. And one of them has a very bad myeloma, which he was absolutely sure was instigated by the booster as he developed the dreadful symptoms. So I want to bring to everybody's attention that I think that this does not look like a coincidence to me. And we need to join forces and see if this is a real effect. And if it is, we must stop all the boosters immediately. Thank you.
Actually, that was his own statement, and I'll put the link to the Tice interview, which goes into a lot more detail, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, this is interesting how this sort of thing happens, because just as Angus Dalglish is coming out with this information saying that these mRNA boosters may have brought on the aggressive relapses and long-term, apparently cured, cancer patients, the good old government is saying, oh, UK plan for national mRNA cancer vaccine advanced. The UK is embarking on an ambitious plan to accelerate research into mRNA cancer vaccines with the German pharmaceutical company BioNTech. Following the success of the COVID vaccines, using the same messenger ribonucleic acid technology, scientists now want to conduct more trials in cancer patients. So on the one side, Big Pharma is saying this is a great idea. On the other side, Angus Dalglish is saying, look, my patients are relapsing. They're coming back into the surgery saying, look, I'm feeling unwell and I'm suddenly a cancer patient again.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that this isn't a thing. It's just that is anecdotal evidence. That's not statistical evidence. And statistical, and I think there is clearly going
to
be.
He's given you the statistics of the number of people coming back to him, hasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, okay, but
it's not just an anecdote. No, it's someone having a chat in the waiting room, is it?
You've got to have proper stats for something like this. You can't just say, I know more people and I think they've got the boosters have caused this. He's
well,
entitled
no one's
to
looking
say
for
that.
The proper stats and no one's paying for the proper
well,
stats.
Well, indeed, the proper stats.
Because the Big Pharma pay for these research.
Well, yes, but Big Pharma should be nationalised and we shouldn't be talking
but
about them at all.
Is it?
No, we're not. But of course, many the mRNA vaccine issues are there and should be addressed. But there's a quite interesting article by Ron Unns this week on his website. I was going to send it to you, but I thought I won't bother because you won't look at it.
Well,
look
I might.
Looking at the stats for excess deaths around
it's
the
really
world.
Very cynical of
and
you, Mark.
Excess deaths around the world. And there has been an increase in excess deaths, but it happened before the vaccine rollout. And he is saying,
during COVID?
No.
Lockdown
No,
deaths.
No. Before the vaccine rollout, during the lockdowns, and and he said, in actual fact, the worst deaths were in countries like the United States with the highest levels of obesity. Now, I think that what he thinks, and he's covered a lot of the evidence, is that COVID itself is a biological warfare agent.
We know that. But anyway, Professor Angus Dalglish, who is a doctor, he also had something to say on the Tice show about the idea that these mRNA vaccines would be good for cancer patients.
I mean, I've been doing cancer vaccines for well over 20, 25 years, and targeting certain cancers with certain antigens, actually, I'll be very honest here, it's actually not been a great success.
Right.
Because you target the tumour with a vaccine targeting the antigen.
Like a sort of hammer.
And the tumour goes, ooh, I'm under attack here, so it down-regulates the antigen, so it carries on,
right?
No longer a target. So obviously the thing to do is you have to use more than one antigen, and that's the type of approach they're using. But I personally, if they had asked me, I wouldn't be rushing in with the messenger RNA technology at all, because I don't think it is, and this goes even more so for COVID, I don't think it's mature enough. Now, right. People say, and I've had...
But it's a trial they've announced, isn't
it? It's a trial, nevertheless, yes.
So in a sense, that's how you progress, by doing the
trials.
That's
how you progress. But people say, you know, I'm an oncologist, I don't know what I'm talking about, and a lot of the people near the advisors just shoo me off like that. But, you know, I must be one of the very few people who sat on a scientific advisory board for a company whose logo is the messenger RNA company. And that was, I left 5 years ago when it merged with, changed its spots, as it were. But I knew then it's far more complex to messenger RNA than we're being led to believe it is. And I think we've got to be very, very cautious. And I would point out that the inventor, the guy who stands to gain the most from this, Robert Malone, he's basically said we should halt too. Now, it's very, very rare that people say stop doing something when they're financially gaining from it.
Yeah, it certainly is. So that's Professor Angus Dalgleish, and I'll put, like I said, a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, it does seem as if what's driving this is patents and profits, not patient care.
Well, I think that's pretty clear. There are bound to be distortions when things are run for private profit in healthcare. There's no doubt about that, and there's a legitimate questions to be asked about that. Ronan's debates with somebody who's opposed to mRNA vaccines on his website this week. Mike Whitney is the moderator of that discussion. I think what Ron Unz is saying, and I'm saying this as well, is that people are failing to understand what's really fundamental about this, is that COVID itself is a biological warfare agent. So that everybody who has died from it is a deliberate war victim, because it's been deliberately released. And therefore, people who are dying from the second tap of mRNA vaccines are just adding to the death toll.
Well,
Kirillov, who's the head of the Russian Chemical and Biological Warfare Forces, is hinting the very same thing.
Okay,
and China and Russia went to the UN Security Council saying, we've discovered all these biological warfare labs in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
What are you up to?
Yes,
and
well,
in other words,
to?
It's not
yeah.
just about
yes, and it's
big
a perfect
pharma
place,
making money.
The most
it?
Crooked country on the planet, Ukraine, is the perfect place to put these little bio labs.
Well, that's exactly why they
Obama
did it,
had kicked them out of the United States. What were they playing at? Apparently, one of the things they were trying to do there was targeting Russian ethnic people with viruses. So anyway, our final clip on the COVID stuff this week is Dr. Vladimir Zevzelenko, who talks about another side effect, this time of what he believes is side effects of the COVID jabs, which is to affect fertility. And here he is chatting with Dr. Joseph Mercola back in 2021.
There's plenty of evidence already that it affects ovarian and testicular function.
Mm-hmm. Fertility.
There's a paper published by the New England Journal of Medicine on vaccination and pregnancy. It was a preliminary analysis and basically concluded that there's no increased risk. But what I did was I looked into the body of the paper and I realized that most of the women in the study that they were using to make that calculation were in the third trimester. And so we could conclude that third trimester immunization did not lead to any increased risk of miscarriage. However, if you look, you stratify to first and second trimesters, so then the risk went up by a factor of 8 to 24X. Me and Dr. Peter McCullough having a disagreement about, I say 8X, he says 24X, because I underestimated certain things. And so I went public with that, I sent that information to Dr. Harvey Reich from MD PhD from Yale School of Medicine and Dr. McCullough. They both came to the same conclusion that that was correct. And then they went on Laura Ingraham and reported it to the world that there is a extremely high increase in spontaneous abortions or miscarriages before 20 weeks in women that are getting vaccinated in the first trimester. But getting back to the fertility issue, sperm counts are going down. Testicular swelling is noted many times. Ovarian function is being disrupted. Women's menstrual cycles are being disrupted. There is an absolute effect on fertility. What degree, we don't know yet, but to say that there's no effect is complete lying.
Well, that's rest in peace, Dr. Zevzelenko. He died last year, but he was basically had a thing called the Zelenko Protocol, which recommended treatment as soon as people got were detected to have COVID rather than jabbing them, Martin. Although, of course, the treatment is extremely cheap, something like 30 pence a tablet, whereas, of course, the vaccines cost a lot more.
Yes. All right. So I'm willing to have this debate, but there's a question that we have to ask here. Is this profiteering by the Pfizer and the other pharmaceutical companies, and they don't really care whether people die or not, or is, as some say, a possibility that they're deliberately making people infertile
kind
and
of
so
eugenics.
On and so forth?
Yeah, maybe.
Now, I think we can rule that out, because the people who've had mRNA vaccines are, by and large, the wealthiest proportion of the population of the planet.
Not in the West, are they?
No, yeah, well, that's
a lot,
right.
A lot of people who are poorer in the world, yes, but
well,
so,
yes,
I mean,
Andrew,
if you're just
the
looking,
world
at,
is the world
if you're just looking at the places where the vaccines have been used, that's not the case.
Well, I know, but that's a secondary question, because in actual fact, millions of people have died of COVID around the world, and COVID itself is a biological warfare agent. Well, what Jeffrey Sachs is suggesting is that it was accidentally released.
Well, you like to talk about COVID itself. I like to talk about the reaction. I think that's the key thing I think people need to understand, isn't it?
Surely
is that it's the reaction to this which is the
most important thing to look at.
But no, Tony.
I think what happens is you want it to just be about vaccines,
and I want it to be about COVID and warfare.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's both.
I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a military intelligence analyst.
Back in the year 2000,
I don't argue with doctors.
There was an organic farmer called Mark Purdy down in Devon talking about vaccines. Right, he was saying that there's a vaccine industry out there, folks. Watch out for it. I rediscovered, and this was one of the videos which was taken off by YouTube when they closed my account back in October last year. Public inquiry that had 25 million hits. It was quite a successful little channel. Of course, they demonetized me as soon as I started actually making a few bob out of it. When I got my other channel, when I got 1.6 million hits on a thing about Brexit, which was a review of Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And we'll be touching on that in a minute. But Mark Purdy, here's the first little clip from him talking about CJD, BSE, and this stuff called organophosphates, which the farmers were pouring down the spines of their cows, and then they were wondering why they got mad cow disease, and that people that ate this meat started getting CJD.
Yeah, I'm Mark Purdy. I'm basically professionally an organic farmer, but I've become very interested in the effect of man-made chemicals on the nervous system, particularly in the way it causes neurological disease and psychiatric diseases and diseases of the immune system that seem to be caused by a widespread array of these types of pesticides and toxic chemicals that have been implanted into the food chain over the last 50, 60 years. In a sense, a campaign has emerged from my research work where I'm trying to stop the use of these chemicals, stop these chemicals actually getting licensed in the first place. I think the first thing is that meat and bone meal, which was blamed for BSE, was actually exported all over the world. It went to countries like Libya and Saudi Arabia, to Malta, to South America, where it was fed in thousands of tons, were fed to the battery dairy herds in those countries. Yet there hasn't been a single case of BSE that's at least been admitted to in those particular countries. And the official body are saying that microdoses of meat and bone meal are causing BSE. But if thousands of tons have gone over to these other countries, then you would get thousands and thousands of cases of BSE. And they're not appearing there. I'm a farmer, so I have a direct experience. My observations of the real world show that the facts that I see don't fit this theory that the government has put forward. And then when you look at the science as well, you see that scientists have done some horrendous animal experiments, which I don't agree with, but on the one hand, they have shown that by feeding massive amounts of this scrapy agent, which is the meat and bone meal ingredient, this doesn't produce BSE disease and the animals that have fed it. And they've done some even more horrendous experiments, injection of scrapie agent into healthy animals. And that too has failed to produce BSE. So, I mean, there are whole rafts of evidence that show that scrapie cannot have caused BSE. I mean, I don't agree with feeding meat and bone meal, and that must have some side effects, but I don't think the side effects are particularly related to the BSE saga.
So I met Mark Purdy at the Green Party about 1998-99, just before that interview was recorded by us, Eye Contact Video Network, back in 2000. But he's starting off, I think, a brilliant piece. I mean, I'll put a link up to the full thing on our show page, as usual, at thisweek.org.uk, the interview with him in his cowshed. And he's saying, look, why is it that we're talking about this? I'm a farmer. None of this makes any sense. They're saying it's this stuff, meat and bone meal, that's called CJD. Of course, I can see quite obviously it isn't. They're feeding it to these herds only being fed this stuff, and they don't get this. He was even talking there about these, I would, you know, call them mad scientists, mad government scientists from the Ministry of Agriculture, actually injecting meat and bone meal into cows, into their bodies to see if it caused CJD, because they just so simply don't want to listen to the other explanations, and that is that these big agrochemical companies are causing this by poisoning the animals.
Well, I think that's a very legitimate point. But of course, the agrochemical companies using organophosphates and so forth and pesticides, that's not really vaccines, is it? It's actually the chemical companies.
Well, it's nothing to do with the vaccine, no. And in fact, he points out that, that when they were mandating, the ministry were mandating this organophosphate treatment, he took a case to the High Court and won. Saying, well, actually, the ministry are mandating this. It's got to be a vaccine or a serum for them to mandate it. And this isn't. It's a chemical dressing. They just pour it down the top of the spine of the cow, and it sinks into the cow's body. And then the cow goes mad with mad cow disease. But it doesn't get the warble fly, which apparently is the thing that it was supposed to stop it getting. So it just seems to me and that these chemical companies, even back then, were just dictating policy.
Yes,
the government was just bending over and doing whatever it wanted.
When I worked on an organic farm in Ireland years ago, they were saying to me that the warble fly, all the warble fly does is it discolours the meat. It makes it look a bit bad. It's got no, it doesn't hurt, you know, you can still eat it, there's nothing the matter with it.
I think it makes a mess of the leather, actually, of the skin.
Yes, all right, so but the point is that in actual fact, I was working on an organic farm in Ireland, and they obviously they weren't using this stuff on their pigs. And they were saying the only reason why you use it on the pigs is because sometimes if you've got warble fly, the meat has got little green spots on it, which is what were left by the warble fly. And of course, if people are going round the supermarket, that's people have got used to the idea that veg and meat should look pristine and be wrapped in plastic. And of course, that means that you have to pour loads of chemicals all over it to make it look as if it's good, where in actual fact, you know, people used to have tomatoes that were a bit green and all the rest of it.
Well, why don't they think about, I mean, it seems to me that sort of thing, what you need is to have spiders around who will catch the warble fly and munch it, rather than pour all these poisonous chemicals into the body
of
the cow.
And I think I mean, obviously I'm not an expert in any of this, but I would suggest that that is a more plausible explanation of what's happened there. And as he pointed out, if it was caused by these, by the feed was exported all over the world. And therefore you'd have expected this to have happened elsewhere other than in Britain. Now, obviously, since BSE was only in Britain, this is a classic scientific experiment, there must be something in the way Britain was doing it that led to it.
Anyway, I will be playing some other clips from that interview with Mark Purdy over the next few weeks. But we're joined now by Joe Banks, freelance journalist here in Bristol. Hi, Joe.
Hi there, good to be here.
You wanted to talk about, well, we've got a couple of things to talk about. One is a bit of history, but also one of the by-elections. So I think let's talk about the history first and then bring it up to date.
Yeah, so we were going to talk, so there's a by-election coming up in Hotwells and Harbourside in Bristol, which is the area obviously around the harbour and by the Avon.
So which councillor has gone and why?
So it's Alex Hartley has resigned on...
citing
mental health.
He was a Lib Dem.
Yep, Lib Dem. And he'll have a little place in Bristol history because he He brought the motion at council
to get rid of Marvin,
basically. Yes. Well, the you know, brought in the referendum. Okay, yeah, brought in
the referendum to get rid of the mayor system and bring back the committee system.
That's it, yeah.
So he's bowing out, Lib Dem. And so who's in the running for this?
So there are four candidates. I'll just quickly mention, then we can get into the history of it. But I guess most interestingly, you've got Stephen Williams coming back for the Liberal Democrats.
Oh, right, OK.
He wants to be a councillor.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, he's the ex-MP, isn't he, for Bristol West?
Well, he was an MP, yeah.
He was an MP from 2005 to 2015.
He also stood to be Metro Mayor, didn't he?
Yes, twice.
He was also a minister in the coalition government. And he was accused knocking back proposals by the Fire Brigades Union to stop these cladding on big tower blocks while he was controversially. So he may have a little bit of a skeleton in his closet.
Yeah, yeah. So he had to give evidence to the Grenfell Inquiry. He was Minister for Communities. So one of the things he's been criticised for is that he didn't read the coroner's report into the Latnell disaster in 2009, which killed six people, which has been seen as this, you know, this event that showed what could happen in a high-rise building through these cladding problems.
But what I seem to remember was, the FBU, the union, Fire Brigades Union, bringing up this thing about cladding, saying, don't you think we need to have a proper look at this? And he knocked it back as minister. But anyway, so he's one of the candidates. Doesn't sound like a very wise decision. It sounds like, to me, it's like his last blast at being a Bristol politician. But anyway,
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, he started as a councillor. That was where he started before he became an MP. It was. I don't know if you want to get into. It was a very close run thing.
In 2021, Alex only just got in. Okay,
he got in by 26 votes in 2021. So he narrowly beat the Green Party candidate. So there's a very strong possibility of the Green Party winning this seat, and then they would become the largest party in the council.
Right. They take that off of Labour. Yeah. Right, okay. So who's the Green candidate is the obvious next question.
The Green candidate is Patrick McAllister, who's a young guy who was the former co-chair of the Bristol Young Greens. He was the treasurer of the Bristol Green Party, a geography graduate from Bristol University, and he stood in the May 2021 elections as a councillor for Knowle. Didn't get in there. But he's, he's...
That would be against Gary Hopkins for the Lib Dems, probably. Gary's quite well known up there.
Oh, he's the Knowle West party.
Oh, is it?
He's not
in Lib Dem anymore, yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah. Of course. Any other in running, or is it just Lib Dems
there's
and
an interesting...
Greens.
Well, there's an interesting Labour candidate, Eileen Means.
They're not popular, are they? Labour aren't really popular.
And she has a slightly checkered history. There's some interesting Bristolian articles about her.
Oh, good. Okay, right. Tell us a little bit about that then.
So
sounds like all these candidates have got a bit of a checkered history.
So there was a Bristolian article in 2015 when I think she was running. She was running to be a councillor in Brislington, and this came out that she had been a director of social services at Reading Council. And it says what the article said, quoting the Berkshire News from an article from 2006. The article said the director of Reading Social Services has quit after her managing skills were criticised. Eileen Means, director of housing and community care at Reading Borough Council, left her post by mutual agreement. Ruth Allman, spokeswoman for the council, said her approach to the management of people and achieving change was not acceptable. As a consequence, Eileen has moved on by mutual agreement.
Well, she could have been elbowed out because she was doing her job too well, or she could have been elbowed out because she was doing it too badly. Who knows? Mm. But, so I would have thought that, the Bristolian, worth saying something about the Bristolian, isn't it? Because it's probably the... We got a copy of it here. Martin was leafing through earlier on. And, for example, there... Christmas edition has a picture of our marvellous mayor saying Marv the Robot the tin-eared tin toy easy to wind up, which is actually a brilliant bit of humour because he is easy to wind up. He's very got a very fragile ego. And so I look at this, I mean, just as myself as a freelance, you know, it's one of the most entertaining rags in town. The Bristol Cable does do stuff where it goes into depth and stuff, but it hasn't got that, you know, when the Bristolian comes out, it's quite nice to get over a copy because it's a bit like Private Eye. It makes you laugh as well as digs dirt.
Yeah, no, it's got a proper satirical edge.
I'm not sure about how incredibly tightly factually accurate it is.
Well, they have a lot of good sources. You know, they're well sourced within the council and places like that.
Well, this information about this lady from Reading, that sounds as if that was out in the public domain anyway. But you're right, they do have good sources.
Yeah,
for example, through trade union networks within the council.
Yeah, yeah, and they, you know, sometimes they go a little too far, but you need people around. But
I don't think you can go too far if you're having a go at politicians. There was this
image they had of Marvin Rees with an axe in his head.
Yeah,
which was pretty nasty. But you need people.
Around. Next to it, it said the best cut of all. I think it was.
It was about budget cuts.
I mean, this is a cartoon, a political cartoon. Yeah. I mean, what's the problem?
No, exactly? What I'm saying is, you need people around who do push it that far.
And I don't know if it's true because it's difficult to quiz the mayor since he won't answer phone calls, he won't talk to me. One of the things that one of the Bristolian people told me was that the mayor actually took that front cover to the police saying this is a clear and present threat against me. My thoughts are, come on, this is a cartoon. Politics is a rough game. You've got to accept that some people are going to take the mickey out of you on the front cover of a satirical magazine. But anyway, this is a, you know, I think perfectly reasonable debate to have about whether that's right or wrong to do that. Anyway, so back to
back to Bristol Media, then the third candidate is the editor of Bristol 24/7.
Oh, right, yes,
Martin,
that's right.
Booth.
Yeah.
Who's standing as an independent. So you know that's an interesting. And who is married to one of the best independent journalists in Bristol, Joanna Booth.
Jo Booth, yeah, that's right. And she does a fantastic blog. She digs dirt as well. And so it's almost as if the journalists are this. That's great to sit here that one of the journalists is standing. It's quite nice to see that the journalists are sort of rather fed up with the political situation and are weighing in themselves. So would you like to say who you think might win and what you think the main issue is going to be in this by-election?
Well,
when is it as well?
So
sorry.
It's the 2nd of February, Thursday the 2nd of February.
Okay, in a couple of weeks, right.
And they're talking, I mean, one of the main issues has been the library, actually, which we talked about last time I was here.
Yeah, that's in the area. Yeah,
yeah.
In the
central library, which was threatened with being moved out of its sort of historic building by the Rees administration, who have now come out in the last few days and said, because Eileen's been going around Hotwells and Harbourside talking to people, and everyone's saying we want to keep central library. They've said they're responding and they're going to keep Central Library as it is.
Yeah, well,
they've saved Central Library.
Well, yes, well, you could cynically say, well, they keep talking about, I mean, the whole library's thing over the years has been, they've been under threat again and again. And anyway, it's nice if people at the City Council, particularly the Mayor Marvin Rees, has decided he doesn't want the school to take over the library and to ship the library out. But who's going to win?
I think Stephen Williams, he is within the context of Bristol politics, a big beast, I guess.
And who was the closest behind Alex for the Lib Dems in the last election?
Well, it was the Green Party who were 26 votes behind.
Wow, so I mean, it's probably...
It could well be the Greens. It could well be the
Especially
Greens.
Especially since this chap doesn't seem to have as much dirt, possibly, as the other candidates.
Yeah. Fresh.
Well, that's...
How many people stood last time?
I think it was four last time.
Because, of course, what can happen in the first past the post election is that people win, but they haven't won 50% of the vote, because the other three votes split it all up. And that's first past the post.
Sounds to me like it's a race between the Lib Dems and the Greens here. It's interesting, Martin, isn't it? The Labour may not get a look in.
Well, if it was a Green Lib Dem marginal last time, that's a pretty safe bet, isn't it?
You had late, so the votes were last time. Green Party 600, the Liberal Democrats winning was 651. Green Party second was 625. And then Labour third with 496.
Yeah, so yeah.
So not a long way behind.
No, but I mean the point is that the Labour vote, if it was a proportional election, they would then be redistributed between the Greens and the Lib Dems, wouldn't they?
I mean, if the Greens do become the largest party on the City Council, what does that mean? I suppose
it means not a huge amount. I mean, practically it
not for
mean
now.
A huge amount.
But when it comes to the committee system, it means a lot, doesn't it? It means the Greens will lead.
There'll be another election then.
That's after the next, you know, actually, so the
in
proper. 20,
in 2024, May 2024, there'll be another there'll be council elections. But I think that then the Greens are highly likely, yeah, to be the main party, the largest party, okay. And that will have more sway. But in the cabinet system, in the mayoral cabinet system as it exists now, having one more Green councillor won't make a huge amount of difference.
No.
But presumably from the Green Party's point of view, they're all working towards this big election that's coming up.
Yeah.
It won't make any difference, really. I mean, it seems to me the councillors don't have hardly any power. The mayor has all the power.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make that. So everything hopefully will change May 2024, and then we will go back to the system. It'd be interesting, actually, to try and... I'll be in contact with Alex, see how he is, and, I mean, find out what's... If he's up for talking, we get him on this programme to talk about why he's stood down, because that's worrying. It may be if he's had some sort of harassment, who knows. But anyway, before we get on to the local history, I hope you don't mind, Joe, but I'm going to go and have a quick look at Westminster, because Sky this week has come out with this brilliant thing called the Westminster Accounts, where you can just go on and find out how much your MP has been taking in private funds.
This week, Sky News has opened the Westminster accounts and been looking for answers on who funds our politics.
There doesn't seem to be anybody here.
We're trying to get in touch with people from MPM Connect.
Yesterday, we finally got some answers from MPs about donations from companies that offer few details about themselves.
One of the biggest things to come out of the Westminster accounts so far is just how hard it is to find out basic details about some companies that give to MPs. And that's why the intervention by Eric Pickles, Lord Pickles, is so interesting and important today. He says that MPs must be able to provide a named individual as being behind a donation, even if it comes from a company. That's a very big change from what happens at the moment.
Sam Coates, Sky News.
So that's just a little bit of the report. So I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the wonderful Sky News Westminster accounts page, where you can just go in and with the Bristol MPs, they're not getting a lot of money, but people like Sir Geoffrey Robertson, for whatever reason, and the number one is Theresa May. If you look at the top 10, Martin, of all the MPs, 9 of them are Tories, only 1 is Labour.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, and of course I understand that the Labour MPs are Chris, David Lammy and Yvette Cooper, who are very much on the establishment wing of the party. I don't think Jerry Corbyn appears in any of this.
Nowhere. No, I think actually our local MPs are about £2,000-£3,000, but May is in the millions.
Well, that's right, and of course Boris Johnson was number 2. He's made millions.
I mean,
filling his boots pretty energetically.
This money is coming into the party 10. That's in power rather than the opposition. I mean, no one's going to give loads of money to the people who are in opposition.
Cooper and David Lammy are potentially in power, and that's why they'll be getting the money.
Well, what about this whole thing he was chatting? That reporter was talking about there, about the idea that you've got companies that don't exist that are paying them the money. This is, I mean, they're saying they're knocking on the door where this company's supposed to be, there's nobody here, and there's nobody seems to know anything about them as they're walking in and out.
Well, it is extraordinary.
Shell companies, I think.
Yes, I mean, MPs are supposed to put down all of their various interests, and of course that and their expenses are supposed to be transparent and so on. But of course, this money, you don't know who's giving it. And of course, this is, am I surprised? No, I'm not. Money is very important in politics. In the United States, it's pretty clear that the people who spend the most money on an election usually win. Not always, usually. And of course, big companies, the defense industry and so on, fund everybody so they make sure that whoever wins, they get what they want.
Well, they fund factions. Maybe it's the Mandelsonian faction within the Labour Party.
Fund both sides, so because it's hedging. Yeah, both sides. Whoever wins, they are beholden to their funders. Of course, in Scandinavia, since World War II, and even before World War II, political parties are supposedly funded by the state, and on the basis of the election results they had the last time they stood. And although that doesn't keep big money out of influencing politics, you know, for example, when the Meidner plan was brought in Sweden to allow wage earner funds, ABBA and all these other wealthy people killed it off. But of course, in the US, even more so than in Britain, big money is absolutely essential if you're involved in politics. And of course, it's got more and more expensive to run elections in the US, to the point where it's a huge amount of money is required. You've got to be a millionaire or a billionaire to stand. And even if you're not when you do stand, once you become a politician, you can expect that you will be a millionaire or a billionaire at the end of it.
Or a European commissioner, maybe. Because the European commissioners are
very much part of the establishment, and many of them are very wealthy. They're not nearly as wealthy as US politicians.
A lot of them are failed politicians as well. Anyway, let's get back to Joe. You wanted to talk about a couple of our local figures and a bit of history, particularly. I mean, we had a miner on before Christmas, who actually, and when I first brought him up on Skype, he had a whole bunch of these lamps behind him. He was talking about the opening up of this new coal mine, which Friends of the Earth are challenging up in Cumbria in order to get coal for smelting steel. He had all these lamps. Now, I didn't realise the inventor of this lamp, the Davy lamp, which revolutionised mining, some would say he was responsible. I'm sure your Extinction Rebellion types would say he was responsible for killing the planet or extincting many, many species. But anyway, can you just tell us a bit about this guy? Because he's from around here, I understand.
Yes. Well, so that's going forward to, that was sort of about 1815 that he invented this lamp. That there were huge problems with lots of miners dying in mine shafts, explosions. And by that point, Humphrey Davy was one of the most famous, well-established scientists in the whole country.
But you're talking a bit about early days.
Right,
yeah.
Back to his youth. And when he was part of this very interesting sort of group of people in Bristol at the end of the 18th century. He's from Penzance in Cornwall, and he's brought to Bristol by a chap called Thomas Beddoes, who had been a professor of chemistry at Oxford, but had to resign his fellowship because in 1793, I think it was, because of his sympathies with the French Revolution and his republican views and his atheism, and moved to Bristol and set up as a physician, basically, in Clifton. And in this area that of Clifton and Hotwells that had become established during the 18th century as a health kind of resort, as a spa, a bit like Bath, because Hotwells is called Hotwells, where this by-election is happening, because of the hot springs which bubble up through the rocks of the Avon Gorge.
Okay, well, this is something which you can apparently, I mean, I'm not sure if I've ever seen it, maybe in a dream, but you could apparently at low tide in the winter time, you can still see a bit of steam coming out. Is that true?
I think that's right. I think there's much
out of the mud.
There's nothing
the
like
Avon
what they
Gorge.
Used to be.
But yeah, as you drive down traces. The portway, which is basically the A4 heading out towards Avonmouth, if you're not paying the ULEZ charge, if you're allowed to drive down
well,
there,
well, you have to pay if you're going down
anymore,
the portway. Yeah.
If your car is the right type of car, anyway, which mine isn't, I'm afraid. On your right hand side, you can see where it used to be the Clifton Rocks Railway, and actually just to the left of the portway into the Avon Gorge itself and the river. You've got remains of a jetty where apparently steamers used to dock at high tide, and people would get out there to actually use this spa or whatever it was.
Yeah. And the springs were documented right back in the 15th century. William Worcester describing the waters as being as milky and warm as those at Bath. And then this reputation develops, and the water of Hotwells is sold all over the country and even internationally. You had Daniel Defoe talking about all the glass houses there were in Bristol in the 1720s. He said, more than in London, and vast numbers of bottles are used for sending the water of the Hotwell not only over England, but all over the world. So it was set up, and people would come, and basically, but it became the reason Beddoes set himself up here, there, was because it was, you had lots of people who were looking to be cured. And he was initially treating tuberculosis, and then he became very interested in gases, which was this emerging, it was this emerging science of gases. Joseph Priestley had sort of with Lavoisier in France, they had sort of at the same time discovered oxygen, and Joseph Priestley, who was interesting, very interesting guy, who was also a philosopher.
So, I mean, is this part of the Enlightenment?
Yes, it was, but it was this period where scientists were also philosophers and poets.
And they called them professors of natural philosophy.
Mm.
I know as well, you know, which is a quite an interesting way to put science. And I know, I mean, that was a fascinating time, wasn't it? Because this was the time that James Watt, for example, was developing this whole idea of the steam engine. And, you know, what they were doing was trying to make sure that these ideas were translated into action. And this was a kind of fuel for the Industrial Revolution.
Yes, and James Watt, yeah, who had invented the steam engine, he was integral to Davy coming to Bristol. Because his son had gone down to Cornwall. He was quite a sickly guy, had gone down to Cornwall to get better, had met Humphrey Davy down there, who was in Penzance. James Watt became aware of him. He then talked to Joseph Priestley about him, and Joseph Priestley recommended, when Beddoes was then trying to set up this pneumatic institute, as he called it, which was going to be both a free medical centre and a kind of laboratory where scientific experiments could take place on the effects of gases on people.
Oh my God!
he was looking for an assistant, and it was through what it was through Joseph Priestley that Davy got recommended, and so he comes up to Bristol, 20 years old, this really dynamic, sort of energetic, tiny little guy. He's only about 5'6", but very, very bright, and joins Beddoes. And Beddoes has established this place in Dowry Square, which is the Georgian Square in Hotwells. And they start doing experiments. Davy starts doing experiments, mainly on himself to start with various gases.
Oh, but it's amazing he survived that, because a lot of this is noxious stuff.
Yeah, well, he nearly killed himself.
Well, I can remember kept doing chemistry at school with Rocky Moore, our chemistry teacher, back in the 1980s, and one of the lads was asked to smell and write down what it smelt like, chlorine. Well, he took a great, great big, you know, lung full of chlorine and just passed out on the floor. He was flat out for about half an hour. Well, actually, we don't know how long it was for, because the ambulance came and took him away. We weren't sure if he was dead or not. But anyway, this is a kind of dicey game.
Well, he was doing that with carbon monoxide, which nearly killed him. And he had to be taken out, and he was sick for days. But he was... this was his approach. Was
a brave, reckless young man.
Yes, absolutely. He tested it on himself. Yeah. Before he would do it on a patient or animals, anything like that, and then they start trying out nitrous oxide, and he quickly discovers that this has fantastic effect.
Laughing gas
is what Davy calls it. That's where the name comes from.
Okay, well, I mean, we see these nitrous oxide silver canisters lying around
everywhere.
Stokes Croft on a Friday night, Saturday night,
right,
particularly, don't we? And all around the city today.
Yeah, you see them everywhere. And I wonder how many people realise that that all started in Bristol.
Very few. So anyway, what about the Davy lamp? Take us fast forward to that, because this was obviously a massive revolution. It enabled a lot safer mine working without things blowing up, and I suppose that was the end of the canary in the cage. It was taken down the mines.
It was, but can I just talk about Coleridge very quickly?
Yeah, of course.
Because this is where, so it's Dowry Square in Hotwells becomes this place where, first of all, he's friends with Robert Southey, the poet in Bristol, who later becomes the poet laureate.
I always thought these guys were down in the Quantocks.
Well, they went. So Coleridge comes to Bristol after university and is great friends with Robert Southey. They have big plans to go to America and start a kind of commune over there, which never comes to anything. And then Coleridge leaves Bristol and goes down to the Quantocks. That's where he's hanging out with William Wordsworth.
Near the Stowey.
Yeah. And they're working on lyrical ballads. And the publisher, the Bristol publisher of lyrical ballads, Joseph Cottle, is also publishing Beddoes' scientific treatises. There's this whole crowd. And originally Coleridge isn't around. He's off on his big trip to Germany. But Robert Southey is coming with other people, and they're starting to hang out with Davy in the lab, sort of after it closes in the evening, and it starts becoming a social event.
Sniffing laughing gas.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they
taking laughing gas and talking about, you know, science and philosophy and all this stuff?
Yeah, Prince Harry would be happy with them.
Yeah,
he would have been hanging out with them.
I'm sure he would have joined in. He would have had a great time.
And then
Coleridge comes back from Germany, and he becomes great friends with Davy. He's involved. He's coming for these evenings, and it has, you know, he'd already had these experiences with opium that he'd got into poems like The Ancient Mariner and Kubla Khan.
This is some of the best material in the English language.
Yes, yes. Yeah, Coleridge is amazing. Samuel Taylor Coleridge is an extraordinary figure. But they were all interested in these sort of transcendent drug-induced states. And Davy himself, you know, although this is a man who would later become president of the Royal Society, you know, he'd become this pillar of the establishment. He was a poet as well and was writing poetry at this time as well, publishing it in Bristol. But he would basically, this all came to an end after about a year, and he gets pinched by Sir Joseph Banks, my namesake, who was the leading figure in the British science establishment. He was then president of the Royal Society, and he was the head of the Royal Institution. And it had been sceptical about Beddoes and what he was up to. You know, Beddoes was a radical, was in favour of the French Revolution, but he could recognise that this kid, Davy, had something about him. And so Joseph Banks sort of pinches him from Beddoes, and Davy goes to London and gets a salaried job with the Royal Institution under Sir Joseph Banks. And had by that point become more interested in batteries and the sort of emerging science of electricity.
Ah, electric cars.
Yeah, yeah. He's the forerunner of Elon Musk.
Okay. But look, I mean, the Royal Society is a fascinating institution, very much written about in connection with the occult, particularly, I mean, many, some of these people I'm sure would have been Freemasons. The Enlightenment was a lot of that was about Freemasonry. But one of the most interesting people who was a scientist was an inventor, who knew James Watt, and probably knew some of these people. He was the secretary of the Royal Society in Edinburgh, whose name was John Robison. And he wrote one of the most fascinating books of proofs of a conspiracy. So we're not talking about conspiracy theory. We're talking about proofs of a conspiracy against all religions and governments. And so his book came out around about the same time as some of the things you're talking about here, 1790s, where he was effectively saying, look, Freemasonry has started out as a great thing. It's been a speakeasy. Everybody who wants to be able to say things that the establishment don't like joins Freemasonry. But it's now being hijacked in the late 18th century. the whole organisation is being hijacked, and he spells out exactly how. So they're a fascinating crowd. Not only are they writing poetry, inventing things which are necessary for the Industrial Revolution to take place, they're also looking at spirituality and philosophy too.
Yeah, and Joseph Priestley is fascinating, who was who was the generation before Davy, but he was run out of Birmingham. His house was burnt down, you know, by a mob because of his support for the French Revolution. And he had to go to London, ultimately had to go to America.
Martin, do you want to chip in about this whole idea of the French Revolution? I know the British establishment was scared to death when they saw what was happening over the Channel, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, if you read Coleridge's... I've not read his autobiography, but I've read a biography of him. And him and Wordsworth were up at, I think it was at Clevedon, and they thought that there were spies spying on them from the British government. And of course it transpired that they were indeed being spied on by the British government. It wasn't just that they were stoned and paranoid. And these people were regarded as a threat. And, obviously Wordsworth eventually became a sort of crusty old Tory in his old age, but in his youth he was, all of these people were influenced by what was happening in France. And Wordsworth said, it was very heaven to be alive, to be too young, was because people saw this as the future. And of course it all then went rather horribly wrong in all sorts of different ways, and the French Revolution ultimately ended up with Napoleon and then with the restoration of the monarchy.
Well, I think we'll just wind up part one by, thanks very much for that, Joe, by just talking about trying to tease out some of the links between what was going on then and today, which is, it seems to me that certain ideas are okay. Almost like someone like Davy, the establishment are watching him saying he's coming up with some interesting stuff, but we don't want him going native, going off on his own. We want to keep him kind of under control.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's a kind of dynamic that never dies, is it? That's always going on.
Well, so let's listen now to an interview that, I mean, someone that died over the holiday is a wonderful woman called Vivian Westwood, who was a big supporter of Julian Assange. And here she is talking to Victoria Derbyshire, who's now on Newsnight from the BBC last year, which is actually, I think it may be 2020, where what she did is she did herself up as a bird in a cage and went outside the High Court as one of the protests against the caging of Julian Assange.
Why do you support Julian Assange?
Because he's got to be let out of his cage and he cannot be extradited to America for his own sake, because he'll be embedded in a concrete jail for the rest of his life, but also because he really is the canary in the cage, which I'm dressed up to be, because I am Julian Assange. And it is a signal for the American government to arrest anybody they like for publishing the truth. And once they do it, then that will be worldwide. And if they're going to arrest Julian Assange for publishing war crimes, which were the truth, then they've got to arrest The Guardian, The New York Times, Der Spiegel, everybody that also co-published this information.
Dame Vivian, if that's how the system really worked, then hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of journalists would be in jail, and they're not. The reason the US wants him to go back to America, they say, is because he tried to hack into a US Department of Defense computer system.
But what I'm saying is that if they arrest him, then they ought to also arrest the other people. But you're saying it's particularly because he's a hacker. Now then, what Americans are doing all the time is that they are fitting him up. They are inventing charges and fit them to him. He's a hacker, so they're charging him with hacking, you know? And that's got nothing to do with anything, because all their charges are worded so as to tick the box. You are guilty because you are guilty. Tick the box. You are a hacker. Therefore, you are a hacker, aren't you? Yes, guilty. I mean, this is the way they are dealing with this case.
But a trial would decide whether he is guilty or not. If he's not, then he can go to America and defend himself.
Yes, so he could from his concrete jail. Now then, but you are assuming that he is the subject of due legal process. And it's the abuse of due legal process in his particular case is so bad that if he'd been a murderer or a drug dealer, it would have been thrown out of court. And you've got to allow me to tell you exactly what has been happening. His all his private discussions with his lawyers were bugged in the embassy by the security firm, and they were fed to the CIA on a daily basis.
How on earth do you know that? How on earth would you know that?
Due process. How do we know that? Because there was a court in Spain, and you have got to do your homework, darling. It happened in Spain.
Can I ask you a question now? Please.
The security firm were told that that's what they had been doing.
Okay, you mentioned The Guardian, you mentioned The New York Times. The Guardian, The New York Times, El País, Der Spiegel, Le Monde, who had all worked with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks previously, publishing carefully selected and redacted documents, absolutely condemned his publishing of unredacted cables, which it's alleged put some informants' lives at risk. Do you have any qualms about Mr. Assange dumping thousands of cables on the internet, which could put some people in danger?
Julian Assange, what happened is that all his stuff was redacted, but The Guardian had the code for the unredacted documents, and they published that code number. And then after that, Julian Assange decided also to release it because he thought all those people whose lives were in danger should be warned about it.
The Guardian say that's absolute nonsense.
The Guardian have campaigned against him. They became an enemy because they were the culprit.
The Guardian say that's absolute nonsense that they did that. Let me ask you again, do you have any qualms about Julian Assange dumping thousands of cables on the internet which allegedly put some people's lives in danger?
There.
I beg your pardon?
You want him in concrete, don't you? All the media, they are just such morons, such spin, brainwashed people. And you're one of them.
Thank you very much for talking to us today. Thank you. Dame Vivienne Westwood, who is a supporter of Julian
Assange. Get me out of the cage!
Get me out of the cage, I think were her last words.
So, well, maybe they were, who knows? But anyway, rest in peace, Vivienne Westwood. God bless you. Fantastic interview you did there. And putting it on Victoria Derbyshire. Of course, you know, professionally as a journalist, you know, she's got to put the opposite point of view. Of course, with people like Krishnan Gurumurthy and the rest of them, many of them, if they've got a nice, cosy interview, in fact, people like Marvin Rees, our mayor, know that they're not going to get these grillings if they go and speak to the BBC here in Bristol. And that is a problem. But, I mean, maybe you first, Martin. This whole issue over The Guardian is a big dispute there about what really went on with The Guardian.
Well, all that Victoria Derbyshire is saying that The Guardian deny it. But if people look into this, they will see that I think it was Luke Harding, and people need to check this, it was The Guardian that released the unredacted files. And that, in fact, Julian Assange was quite careful not to release unredacted files. So that is just a canard, basically. And, of course, Victoria Derbyshire, really, and as Vivienne Westwood pointed out, you haven't done your homework, love.
What do you make of this, Joe, this whole Assange business?
I don't know if I've got a great deal to say about Julian Assange. I mean, just listening to Vivienne Westwood, I think of her contribution to youth culture and that time in the 70s with Malcolm McLaren and the shop it was her shop Sex, wasn't it, on the King's Road, which was the which feels like to me like the last hurrah of a really exciting youth culture in this country.
Martin?
Well, I was a youth in that era. Yeah, I remember it well.
I mean, the punk thing was almost a reaction against this sort of things like the supergroups and the ABBAs and people like that of the era, saying, well, actually, look, we want to... And you were talking about this when we were talking about Terry Hall the other day, that there was a wish to get beyond that, that the music industry should be just anybody in their garage kind of thing, making a song and getting it to number one, because it was a lot better in terms of sort of political, social content than the stuff that was being churned out by the industry.
Well, let me tell you what happened. We heard about the famous Grundy interview where the Sex Pistols swore on, you know, live TV and all the rest of it. And we hadn't heard any of the music. It just filtered through to us. I was 16 at the time. And, we knew immediately that we wanted to hear this music. We also heard that they got this thing called God Save the Queen, which was about the Jubilee, the Silver Jubilee. And of course we hadn't heard the music, but the whole thing of it immediately. And we went to the record shops and we queued up outside the record shops to get the record. And we got the record. And of course the record could have been rubbish. And then we put it on. It was like, wow, it was a bang. Mm-hmm. And it was just everything. And immediately, for example, we all changed what we were wearing. It was straight jeans, short hair, completely different clothes from the ones that we'd been wearing previously, and a whole different attitude. And of course, on the back of that, we then got the with the John Peel show and all the rest of it. All of these, you know, anybody could form a band and hope to get coverage and some kind of career in the industry. Whereas previously, of course, we'd been listening to Queen, who were playing massive gigs at Wembley Stadium and what have you. And it was just, there was no real identification with that. Although, of course, the music was okay, but it wasn't ours. This other stuff, I mean, loads of my friends formed bands on the back of this, and some of them were reasonably successful.
Well, the fact is, for someone like John Peel was around, and you could... So I like to think of this show a bit like a sort of talk radio version of the Peel show. I worked with an engineer at the BBC who'd engineered Peel's programmes, and he said he was the loveliest guy to work for because he had no ego. He just saw everybody as, you know, he didn't take any ego to the mass media for his Radio 1 show, and of course he was from Pirate Radio before that. But I always remember him telling me how it was frustrating working with him sometimes, because he'd get a buzz saying, well, there's something wrong with one of the turntables, you come and fix it in the middle of a live programme. And John would be sat there with his feet up on the mixing desk with the monitors blasting out. You could hardly make your ears bleed at the top volume. And of course the BBC now is much, much better behaved than it was in John Peel's days. But the fact of the matter is, you could get your band stuff onto the Peel show, couldn't
you? Yes, well the other important thing was we didn't have any other place to listen to this kind of music. So everybody, for years, we used to come home from the pub and switch it on, because we couldn't record it either. Well, we could have done it if we were there, if we could press a button. And that meant that you had to listen to loads of stuff you wouldn't otherwise have listened to. Yeah, the whole Top of the Pops thing, which has now gradually dissipated, everybody had to listen to everything. Whereas now, of course, what you've got with the access that people have through Spotify and so on to all sorts of music is you end up listening to the same stuff over and over again.
And you can never have a national moment, you know, like the Pistols bursting through TV screen like that.
That's right.
You can't have that.
Yes, it's gone.
Now. Yeah.
It's gone. It's much more diffuse now.
Mm. Sorry, we've got about 300 channels or something, haven't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone's streaming their own.
Yeah, but the point is that people just and it even says preview. If you like this previous record, you'll probably like this other one. So in other words, the algos decide what you're going to listen to. Whereas, and the other thing about John Peel, some of the stuff he played was absolutely execrable.
Yeah,
you know, like five minutes of people screaming or whatever. You know, and here's the latest from Yoko Ono. You know, so 20 minutes. But you had to listen to it if you wanted to listen to the next bit.
That's right. I think he used to do that to just sort of wind people up. Yeah. So the idea was, well, look, the unfaithful will be tuning out now, but we've got a cracking tune coming at the end of this.
Well, that's something I heard. There was a quote from Tom Waits, I think it was, the other day, saying that, you know, in the past you had to go to people who ran bookshops or record stores were these sort of gurus or gatekeepers or people with a kind of secret knowledge who would, you know, who could act as a sort of kind of portal, but it was a human.
Yeah, you had to go and you had to go and meet the people concerned and badger them. Come on, play my record or whatever. Mm. Yeah.
So yes, and it's awful to see the way. I mean, I actually met the controller of Radio One up at BBC Bristol as part of the, I think it's called the Radio Society or Radio Club or something. We were invited up there when I was at BCFM. I spoke to him about John Peel, and you could just wave a. Your hand in front of his face, there's nobody in. It's like, who's John Peel? Don't know who he is, you know. Oh, really? So this is the modern. These people are just put in, basically, it's a sausage factory now. And the new director general of the BBC, Tim Davey, is the ex-marketing guy from PepsiCo. So that's where we are now, folks. Anyway, look, thanks ever so much for coming in and chatting about this interesting bunch in Dowry Square, and of course the by-election, which we will be covering in 3 weeks' time on this programme. And in the meantime, let's have a bit of music. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Guess that's what you used to call a 12-inch, but it may well actually be a much more recent re-recording of the Specials there and Too Much Too Young. We did, for our Christmas show, we did quite a lot about the sad death of Terry Hall and his role, particularly in exposing child abuse, as we later found out. Quite a lot of his songs had hints at that, because he was abused as a young man. And before that song from the Specials, where was Van Morrison, Whenever God Shines His Light. Well, I think actually I played Cliff Richard then. I don't normally like playing Cliff Richard as well, but I'm afraid I ought to have been a bit more diligent and found a version of that, Whenever God Shines His Light, with Van Morrison alone, without Cliff.
I don't have a lot of time for him. But anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We'll plunge straight into part two with a look at Biden. Martin, we were talking just now about Julian Assange and all the time he's done for so-called hacking. Well, of course, he wasn't a hacker. He's taken information from leakers who have got military clearance that maybe they're the people who potentially should be sued, but a journalist who then publishes that information shouldn't. But Biden apparently has been leaving these classified documents lying around, so maybe he should be done under the Espionage Act.
Well, that's what Trump's suggesting, isn't he? The thing about the hacking is that it's which they're talking about is what's her name, Chelsea Manning, was supposedly the hacker. But of course, they've only brought this out, this hacking thing. He was originally charged, supposedly, with rape. And then, they keep changing what they're charging him with. And if people can't see what's wrong with that, then I have a Magna Carta to sell you.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Biden trying to answer questions about this. Apparently a load of files left in his Corvette, some vintage car which was left in a garage. But apparently, Martin, all these secrets were safe because the garage was locked.
Classified material next to your Corvette. What were you thinking?
Let me, I'm going to get a chance to speak on all this, God willing, soon. But as I said earlier this week, people, and by the way, my Corvette's in a locked garage. Okay? So it's not like you're sitting out in the street. But anyway.
It's in a locked garage.
Yes, as well as my Corvette. As I said earlier this week, people know I take classified documents and classified material seriously. I also said we're cooperating fully and completely with the Justice Department's review. As part of that process, my lawyers reviewed other places where documents from my time as vice president were stored, and they finished the review last night. They discovered a small number of documents of classified markings in storage areas and file cabinets in my home and my personal library. This was done in the case of the Biden Penn Center. The Department of Justice was immediately, as was done, the Department of Justice was immediately notified, and the lawyers arranged for the Department of Justice to take possession of the document. So you're going to see, we're going to see all this unfold. I'm confident.
The press conference given by Biden a couple of days ago, Martin, when this was announced. He's been a bit of a naughty boy, hasn't he, really?
Well, it may be that he's not been looking after classified documents properly.
When he was vice president.
Yeah. It may be that these documents have been seeded to undermine him by people within the deep state.
He's not denying it, though, is he? I mean, you thought if someone's planted this stuff that he would say no.
Well, I mean, the other thing which is going to come out is links with Burisma Holdings in Ukraine and his son Hunter Biden's being on the board. And he's on the record as saying that he got the public prosecutor in Ukraine sacked so that they couldn't look into Burisma Holdings. Now, all of this is a sewer, and it may be that the Republicans who now control Congress are going to try and get into this sewer, and Trump certainly is pushing them to do so. So Margaret Kimberly Green, or whatever her name is, the Trumpite congresswoman, she is the one who's saying that we're going to have to audit the books of the money that's been sent to the Ukraine. Now, this is partisan political advantage being played by the Republicans in the US, but it really is a very dirty story. Because as vice president, Biden was involved in the whole coup attempt, the coup in 2014 in Ukraine, and so on, why we ended up where we are now.
Viktor Pinchuk's coup, by the way, folks, if you want to look him up.
Well, the CIA's coup. Pinchuk is only a local guy.
Yes, that's right. Well, he was the Ukrainian chief in charge of the coup in Kiev.
Well, there's a guy called Boyenga who's actually in charge of the snipers that killed all the people in the Maidan Square. That's what he said his name was to the snipers. And we know that from a court case in Kiev in 2017. None of which has reached the mainstream media. It was reported on Russia Today, and I commented on it at the time.
So the war is progressing. It's been going for nearly a year now in Ukraine between Russia and NATO and Ukraine. The Germans this week, Martin, because the Ukrainians are running out of tanks. A lot of the tanks are getting blown up by the Russians. Germany says Poland can now start sending tanks to Ukraine. The Pentagon, though, is pushing back against Boeing, who plan to send the long-range bombs over to Ukraine.
Well, they are feeding weaponry in, and there's this kind of machismo test going on about which countries are prepared to supply the most dangerous stuff to the Ukrainians. But from a military point of view, this is too little too late. It's never, and don't forget, a lot of the stuff that's been supplied to the Ukraine has simply been stolen. Much of it does never get there. It's a lot of virtue signalling, if you can call trying to prolong a war as long as possible virtuous. It's virtue signalling by various politicians in the West.
Now, we talked last week a bit about this Stop the War conference, which is taking place next weekend in London. No speakers from China putting a Chinese point of view, or speakers putting a Russian point of view, nor speakers putting a Yemeni point of view or an Iranian point of view. So this whole Stop the War business, and we did mention it a bit last week, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I see that, you know, Yemen has almost been totally forgotten. Oxfam, which is one of those organisations I keep hearing news stories saying, oh, Oxfam are terrible. No, they're not. They're being smeared. Oxfam finds scores of civilians killed by the United States and UK weapons in Yemen. A human rights monitoring group has released a new report finding at least 87 Yemeni civilians have been killed with British or American weapons during just a 14-month recent period. The Oxfam reviewed 1,700 attacks on civilians and found Saudi Arabia had used US and UK weapons in over a quarter of these incidents. Oxfam reviewed incidents that occurred between January 21 and February 2020. The author of the report, Martin Butcher, Oxfam's policy advisor on arms and conflict, said, "The intensity of these attacks would not have been possible without a ready supply of arms. That's why it's vital the UK government and others must immediately stop the arms sales that are fueling the war in Yemen." And yet we keep hearing about Ukraine. We keep hearing stories about the Russians killing civilians in Ukraine. Well, of course, there are some being killed. But, you know, for a full-scale war that the Russians are waging over there, they seem to be killing very few civilians, in fact.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is what Brian Eno, who is chair of Stop the War at one stage, calls propaganda. In other words, what we've got to talk about is Ukraine. Let's not discuss Yemen, because Saudi Arabia invaded the Yemen. And you could argue that that is actually in breach of the UN Charter, and they should be under sanctions or possibly invaded and have their government overthrown. Considering that the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were all from Saudi Arabia, why did we invade Afghanistan?
Well, they reckon about 500,000 people have been killed in Yemen in the eight-year war.
And also, there's a full blockade on the Yemenis, on the Al-Ansar movement, and that means essentially trying to starve the population into surrender.
UK Stop the War are not interested in anybody from the Houthi side speaking at their conference.
Well, I think that's not necessarily the case, Tony, because Stop the War, do you remember that British soldier is of Yemeni origin who carried out a protest outside the in London? Stop the War were quite vociferous in his support. I think you'll find that Stop the War are quite good on Yemen. Nobody reports Stop the War. They don't report Yemen. They don't report Stop the War. I think over the Ukraine, there's clearly a split developed on the left between those who see what's happened as Russian aggression. Paul Mason would fall into that category. He's not really a member of
Stop the Wars. That's what Stop the Wars say. They want the Russians to withdraw from Crimea too.
No, well, I think what they're actually saying
there's been
an evolution, as far as I can see, in this, which is that they're calling for a ceasefire and negotiations.
I think you need to look at the publicity for this next weekend.
You've got to understand that these people are not necessarily... If you're called something like Stop the War, you can't say, but the Russians are justified in invading Ukraine. I think they are justified, but you can't say that with a Stop the War hat on.
No one's expecting them to say that, but what they've been saying is the Russians have got to withdraw. You know, so anyway...
Well, I don't think they're saying that.
Yes, they are. Look at the publicity, Martin. I don't think you've been looking at the publicity.
Well, no, I think
the Russians
have
got to leave the whole of Ukraine, including Crimea. That's their position.
I haven't followed what Stop the War's position is in detail.
I mean, you were a part of Stop the War Bristol at one point. What happened to that?
Well, what's happened to it is it gradually dissipated over the years. I mean, we were very, very active. We used to have weekly meetings, and it was when the big 2003 demonstration took place, Bristol sent 66 coaches to that demonstration, and we still had loads of people. Yeah. We
so it seems to me it's been basically sidelined itself, or it's been infiltrated.
Well, the problem is that the world is complicated. And therefore,
it's
find
not galvanising the support to stop these various wars that are coming. The next ones,
yeah, I know, but it's all
not
very
doing
well
anything like it was doing in the run up to Iran,
I know, but that's because that was a British invasion of a sovereign country in defiance of the UN Charter. It was a fairly clear cut case. Whereas what's happened in Ukraine is messy, a bit like what happened in Yugoslavia. It's hard to take a side unless you really know what's going on, and most people obviously don't really know what's going on.
It doesn't seem to me that stop the war is anything like what it says on the tin. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Scott Ritter, who does seem to know what's going on over in Ukraine, the ex-US Marine Corps intelligence officer and the Iraq weapons inspector that resigned when the NATO countries, the British and the American so-called coalition of the willing, or whoever they were at the time, decided, oh, we're just going to invade anyway, no matter what Scott Ritter and his intelligence people say. And here he talks about the battle for Soledar and Bakhmut with Garland Nixon.
I forget how many, you know, French tanks, the AMX-10, it's a wheeled vehicle. It's not really a tank. I think it'd be classified as a light tank on best, or a medium armored car. But it has a survivability factor of zero in modern combat. The Bradley, which variant are they getting? Are they getting the one with all the bells and whistles, the upgraded variant? Are they getting old ones that have been mothballed that are going to be brought out, like the old M113s that we brought out, made to function and then turned over? The same thing with the Marder. That's a German infantry fighting vehicle. Are they getting the new ones with all the bells and whistles? Or are they getting ones that have to be brought out, refitted, repaired, and then turned over?
The Marder, that's an ironic name, particularly in this conflict. But let's continue.
Yeah, but my point is what? It's 50 Bradleys, 80 Marders, that's 130. Zeluzhny said back in November he needed 500. He ain't getting 500 on tanks. He said he needed 300. He's not getting anywhere near 300. There's some talk about people providing Leopards and all that, but they haven't crossed that line yet. The British are talking about the Challenger 2. When all these tanks came out, they were gee whiz tanks. But these aren't brand new tanks. These are old tanks. And more importantly, they're old tanks that the Russians have been spending years preparing to defeat in combat. The Challenger 2 wasn't designed to take on the T-90, MB-3 or whatever the variant is out there. Its armor can't survive being hit by the Russian anti-tank rounds. The Russians outgunned them, outranged them. I might be able to say if they were fighting the British, but you got some really good British crew. I mean, if you take a guy who's, driven the same Camaro his entire life, and he knows everything about that Camaro, every sound, noise. He knows exactly when to do this. So he can take a machine that isn't as efficient as others, but he knows how to get the best out of it all the time. He might win the race, even if he's racing faster cars. But so we take a Ukrainian crew and we put them in a Challenger 2, and they don't know anything about this tank. They don't know, so they're out there sort of trying to get a feel for it. They don't know how to maximize its pluses, and they don't know how to minimize its minuses. Meanwhile, they're going up against a T-90, MB-3 tank. Goodbye, desvidaniya. That's all she wrote. You're going to die. I feel bad for the Ukrainians. I really do, because, let's say you're Ukrainian now launching an offensive. Remember, every army prepares to fight the last battle. So the Ukrainians' last offensive battle was one where they were able to achieve great penetrations through thinly held defenses. And now they're going to come in and they're going to try and replicate that. But if the Russians do what I said they should be doing, which is a phased operation, linking in everything, these guys are going to try and come rushing in, and they're just going to get hit right in the face. They're going down. It's going to get ugly quick. And because they don't have 500 infantry fighting vehicles, they're going to run out of oomph really quick. I think, all this does is extend the battle, the Russian offensive by a couple weeks, because the Russians will have to, of course, defeat these three brigades when they're thrown in on the battlefield. But the Russians will defeat them, and then the Ukrainians will have nothing, and they'll move on. I mean, what happens when you destroy 50 Bradleys? Because they're going to be destroyed. What's to replace them? I can tell you what's going to happen if the Ukrainians destroy 50 BMP-2 or BMP-3 armored fighting vehicles. The Russians have 50 more. It'll come in that quick. The Russians ain't going to run out of equipment. Their defense industry, I mean, NATO hasn't woken up to the fact that, Putin signed off on a new prikaz or directive that expands the Russian military to 1.5 million. They're going to increase the contract soldiers, but they're also going to increase conscription. They're forming a whole bunch of new airborne units, a whole bunch of new marine units. These are forces that are expeditionary in nature, so they aren't linked to a specific geographical region. They can be brought in to do things, more artillery. In order to support all this, their defense industry is already ramped up. They're already producing at max efficiency. Weapons are already coming off the production line. Meanwhile, back in Western Europe, ain't nothing like that happening. Poland is building a single division. They're equipping it with equipment that they don't produce. Other people do, but they're going to buy old M1 tanks. They're going to buy new tanks from the South Koreans. It's going to take time. But then that's it. What's Germany doing? What's France doing? What's Belgium doing? What's Netherlands doing? What's Denmark doing? What's NATO doing? And the answer is nothing comparable. Literally, what's the United States doing? I mean, if I were an American military planner right now, I'd be telling the President of the United States, we need to activate 3 armored divisions right now. Not because we need them today, but just so they're available in 2 years. But we need to get 3 divisions up and running. Now, they'll come back to me and say, we have a recruiting shortfall of 6,000. I don't know where you think you're going to get the troops to do this. And that's a different question altogether. Leadership will have to come up with a solution. But the bottom line is, if we think we're going to take on the Russians, and I'm not talking about force on force, but
right.
Make a presence known, we need to have forces capable of establishing and sustaining a presence. And we're not doing that.
Well, I can say this as a person who was a former hovercraft pilot when I did search and rescue on the bay. That Slingsby Aviation, SAH 2200 hovercraft. I could take that thing and run it 50 knots across the ice. I could do a 180 and use the prop watch to stop it. I ran that thing every day. If you don't know what you're doing with that, and I try to train you a couple weeks and you run that thing off the ice, you are dead. When you get up to 50 knots, you will never get it stopped, and it's flipping and you're done and you're never going to come home again alive. So a very expensive piece of equipment made in England. So I understand what you're saying when it comes to, I can give you the best tank in the world. If you don't know what you're doing with it, you might just kill yourself running off something or going, or screwing it up. If not, God knows when you come up against a tank crew or a tank division of people who have practiced maneuvering together, they're going to go through you like a hot knife through butter.
So that's ex-US Marine Corps Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter there, chatting away with Garland Nixon about British-made hovercraft. Now, it just sounded a little bit dicey, that manoeuvre he was talking about, turning, flipping it around at 50 miles an hour and then using the blades on the back to slow the thing down, rather than, because you've got no brakes on a hovercraft. But anyway, the point he's making, Martin, is absolutely key, isn't it? It doesn't matter how many tanks that are handed over to the Ukrainians, unless they're crewed by Brits or Americans, they're going to be virtually useless.
Well, it may well be that they are going to be crewed by NATO personnel. It's the HIMARS that they've been using, it's pretty clear that they are being fired by probably Polish regular military who are being sheep-dipped as mercenaries, because you can't train people on this equipment very quickly, and the Ukrainians aren't trained to use it. They were trained to use Soviet-era kit. And, of course, a lot of that Soviet-era kit has now been destroyed, and a lot of the people who were trained to use it have been killed. As von der Leyen managed to release by accident, they've had 100,000 military casualties on the Ukrainian side. They're being eaten alive. But, of course, the media in the West are still pushing the line that Putin is losing and he's going to lose power sometime soon and all the rest of it, which just shows you how there's no sense in saying things like that. It's just basically nonsense. But they keep coming out with it because that's the line they've been taking from the beginning.
Now, I like to bring in this whole issue of JFK as often as possible, really, especially since it seems absolutely blindingly obvious to me that the people behind it were the CIA, in the specific individual David Attlee Phillips, plus the Chicago Mafia that were brought down to kill JFK in Dallas in the 1960s. But we're going to have a listen now to someone who agrees with that, who's a former FBI officer, retired now, called Zach Shelton. And as I said at the start of the show, he informed a private investigator, Joe West, who went down to interview James Files, who was in prison at the time. Now, Files himself, I mean, the interview, long interview with him that was done after the death of Joe West is an absolutely fascinating listen, and includes Files talking about the various times, I think it's three in total, where people tried to kill him, because obviously he knew a bit too much about the death of JFK, having killed him. Where he, because he was trained in live firefights over in Korea, he kept guns with him all the time. And as soon as someone, it looked like, was trying to kill him, he would be firing back almost before they let off the first shot. So that's why James Files is still alive, even if he was incarcerated. So let's have a listen to Jack Shelton, the FBI guy, who put the world in the form of Joe West and the rest of us onto James Files as the killer on the grassy knoll.
In 1987, a guy by the name of Rademacher, a young guy in his 20s, a theorist, conspiracy buff, had a metal detector, and he's going all around up there on the knoll, and he finds a .222 casing, and according to, that's supposedly been in there since probably, probability is in the early 60s, and had a human tooth mark in it. Now, don't know. Another interesting thing that Files says is that he went down in a 1963 white over maroon Impala Chevrolet. He parked his car face in across the street from the book depository where the Dowtex building is, on the side of the Dowtex building. He drove away with Roselli and Nicoletti in the car. They met at the Impala, and they took off. Interesting thing about that, there is film footage of the caravan turning off of Houston onto Elm, and in there you see a 1963 white over maroon Impala. Kind of corroborates him. But also there's a guy named Malcolm Summers who later sees 5 to 10 minutes after a maroon Chevrolet, 61 or 62, leaving with three guys in it. And you also have a guy by the name of Watson that basically says the same thing. He saw he's even more specific. It's a 1963 maroon Impala, which corroborates Files. The other thing that corroborates Files is the acoustics test. When I talked to Gary Cornwell, I told him about Files, and he says, where did Files say he shot from? And I wasn't specific on the exact footage, But I called the producer in California, and when I told him where File said he was standing, he got a big smile on his face, and he told me that's exactly the same spot the acoustics test puts the shooter. And he says nobody's been able to match that spot of anybody that said they were there. Beside that, there's a photograph, the famous Mary Mormon photograph of a lady that's across the street from the grassy knoll that took a picture exactly at the same time that Kennedy's head's going backwards. When I saw that photograph, I said, if Files is telling the truth, there has to be somebody behind that picket fence. And I blew up that photograph as much as I could. And there's something. I mean, you can't, it looked like a human figure, but it's definitely somebody behind that picket fence, exactly where Files said he was standing.
So maybe that's the last honest FBI officer remaining. Certainly Martin does point to this being, I mean, this whole idea that Lee Harvey Oswald was involved is complete nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the primary events of the 20th century, isn't it? Mm. And Kennedy,
a turning point for the Western world.
Yeah. And I'm pleased to say, speaking of pop heroes, as we were discussing earlier, that Bob Dylan produced a free single which he put out over the internet during the lockdown, which was called Murder Most Foul, and it was a classic Bob Dylan drone about how terrible it all was and that Kennedy had clearly been murdered by the government. And that, you know, some of these people sell out, you know, but I think Bob Dylan, millionaire, billionaire that he is still not prepared to let that go because he's from the generation that remembers it.
Well, it's also, how I mean, you could say the same about Van Morrison, actually, because he was very much of a stickler about what was going on with COVID. And one of the very few people...
It's not the same, Tony.
It is.
He was wrong about COVID, whereas Bob Dylan is right about
this. You're wrong about COVID, actually.
No, right.
But anyway,
I don't agree with that.
He's extremely... I think Van Morrison was one that didn't sell out, like so many of these musicians did sell out.
Let's go back to JFK.
Bob Dylan didn't sell out either. But anyway, I just wanted to go on now to talk a bit about Shamima Begum, because that was one of our little investigations we did on here, when we were live on the programme in BCFM. And whilst we're talking about BCFM, very sad to hear he's in chemotherapy now, Patrick Hart, who was our station manager on there. Would be nice to be still working with him, but unfortunately not. And blessings to you, Pat. Hope you have a recovery as soon as possible from any chemo that you're in. So Shamima Begum was a weird one, wasn't it? We actually came across this kind of conjunction of the planes live on air at BCFM about this story that about someone being arrested with a laptop over in Turkey. And yet this was on the laptop were the names of these girls who had mysteriously disappeared from Bethnal Green. So we put two and two together and realised that actually it was a Canadian intelligence officer, according to the Turkish police, who'd recruited them. But the BBC did a piece this week, I think maybe next week, they've got part two, and it's called I'm Not a Monster, looking into the whole Shamima Begum case and talking to people who were working with Muslims in Bethnal Green before she left.
Salman is the guy I was filming with in East London Mosque back when the girls disappeared.
And what did he say?
He said there are some families here, they've lost their kids, they think they're going to Syria, and you have to help stop them or bring them back.
And why would Salman pick you?
Well, I've known him for a while, and he knew that I was involved in doing quite a lot of work with terrorism cases. And so that means that you have a reach into various communities that other people may not necessarily have a reach into.
Taz agreed to help. He began by searching the girls' homes for clues. I want to know if he can tell me anything about how Shamima's journey to ISIS began.
The reason I'd gone there is because I wanted to try and find out if there's any scraps of any information that would help us work out if the girls were in contact with anybody. That was the plan. There were no receipts, there's no phone bills, most of their clothes were in place. There was no indication of any sort of planning, any sort of outside contact on anything written or electronic.
What does that tell you?
Well, I'm a criminal lawyer that's been working for about 20 years, and I deal with criminals on every level, and criminals tend to want to avoid being caught but I'd never seen anything so thoroughly dry cleaned of evidence or information as had these young teenagers managed to do themselves. So that was very, very surprising to me.
How would they obtain the knowledge to do that?
Well, they wouldn't have been able to do that on their own. That, to me, told me that they had been very strongly advised and very professionally advised on steps to take to avoid detection, and they'd also adhere to those steps in a very careful way. Now, that in itself is noteworthy.
Why?
Well, it shows a level of commitment. So these were intelligent girls who were committed to a plan to leave, and also that they must have had a great deal of trust in whoever it is that they were speaking to follow their advice very, very carefully.
Taz suspected the girls had been given clear instructions about how to cover their tracks, and that they put real effort into following that advice, leaving nothing behind. Well, almost.
Now, in Shamima's house, she wasn't maybe as careful as the others. There was a scrap of paper that we found with a shopping list on that.
Taz pulls up a picture of the list on his massive screen. It's written in what looks like a school planner. On the left-hand side, there's a series of items, a bag, makeup, boots. And next to each item is a name or initial. There's S&K, presumably for Shamima and her friend Khadija. There's an A for Amira, marked next to vests. Then on the right-hand side is what looks like how much each item will cost. There's a phone for £75, socks for £4, taxi for £100. It's an itemised list of what they think they'll need for a trip to the so-called caliphate. There's even money marked down next to the word billet, which happens to be Turkish for ticket. The list shows that Shamima and her friends didn't just run off to ISIS. They had a plan.
So January 2015, you're planning to go to ISIS. How do you learn what to do?
People online telling us and, like, advising us on what to do and what not to do. Just like how to get the money to buy the tickets, where to buy the tickets, which airport to go to, what to bring, what to wear when you're going to the airport, who to talk to, who not to talk to, what excuse to make if you do get caught, you know. I mean, it was just like a long list of detailed instructions.
The voice of Shamima Begum at the end there, Martin. This is a bit of a can of worms has opened up here, hasn't it? Interesting that they've got the right Turkish words for these things. They're being given all sorts of, she's quite clear, advice. Now, it's quite obvious as well to me. Go and have a look in the Facebook database. You'll find all of this material because that's where they were chatting with these people on Facebook who, this specific guy, we're told by the Turkish police, recruited them on Facebook, was working for Canadian intelligence, and Facebook will have all the records.
Yeah. Well, what's happened in this particular case is a tip of an iceberg. Because in actual fact, what was happening during that era, which is not that long ago, was that people from all over the world were being funneled into Syria to overthrow the evil Assad government. And they were being aided and abetted by intelligence agencies, including the British intelligence agency, which was working very closely with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And of course, what Shamima Begum's case shows is that in actual fact, the groomers who were grooming them were working for Western intelligence agencies. And the Western intelligence agencies were embedded in the insurgency inside Syria, which has pretty much been comprehensively defeated by the Syrian Arab Army and their Russian and Iranian allies. And incidentally, there's been a meeting this week in Moscow between the Syrian government and the Turkish government to try and settle the business in Syria, which, of course, has not been presented in our media at all.
Well, also, they've been saying, well, they're right, it hasn't, but Assad has been telling the Russians, apparently, that that deal must result in the withdrawal of Turkey, which is obviously a NATO country.
Well, the Turks invaded, they basically invaded Syria. which of course is an invasion.
Have they just used the conflict with the Kurds in order to sort of infiltrate them into Syria?
That's right, there's a lot of complications in this. We could go on to discuss what's happened in Nagorno-Karabakh between the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis. But don't forget, what we've really got to concentrate on, Tony, is Ukraine, because that's what we're being told is the latest thing. And that's the thing we need to worry about. So what happened in Syria 5 years ago, we don't need to know about that. Why do we need to know anything about that?
South Korea, well, we know that. The Americans might not have got that, but the Brits did. South Korea threatens it may seek its own nuclear weapons this week, we hear.
Well, they probably could produce nuclear weapons. They're technologically sophisticated enough. What would they do with them? I mean, the reason why the North Koreans have got nuclear weapons is they can nuke Japan, who is the traditional enemy of Korea. And the Korean War in the 1950s began because of Korea was partitioned between the Russian-controlled North, as it were, or the Chinese-controlled North and the South. But the Chinese, the Korean Communist Party had been the main opposition to the Japanese occupation from 1905 onwards. And they were massacring communist militants in the South, which is why the North Koreans invaded the South, which, of course, is not presented in any of the histories that we read.
Well, so before we wind up and listen to a piece about the Knights Templar, as it's Friday the 13th, and Bristol was, or some would say is, a Templar port. Let's have a little, because there's something big going on this weekend at Davos. Who are these WEF people? We seem to be hearing more and more and more about them. Their Great Reset. King Charles and Klaus Schwab seem to be this sort of duo in charge.
Klaus Schwab and Prince Charles are not in charge of WEF.
Yeah.
They're not. They are the front people that we know about. The people who are really running it are probably unknown, even to people like us who pay attention.
We're talking about possibly people from these private equity firms.
That's right. Schwab is basically a factotum. You know, he was very close to Henry Kissinger and all the rest of it. And he's presented in the kind of alt-right media as he's the evil genius behind it all.
His family apparently was involved in
they are not the chiefs of it. That's silly.
Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Piers Corbyn, who I spoke to earlier this week. I asked him about, he seemed to be the best person to sort of ask about the World Economic Forum, since he's been taking on so much of what they're doing around the UK, and this whole idea of almost privatising government. There's quite a big organisation, I know you're a big fan of, Piers, called the World Economic Forum meeting this weekend. I love the way, I don't know if you're going to be able to do a protest, I think you probably better have some very warm clothing, maybe some skis, a snowmobile, because they do this, don't they?
In
Switzerland, which is a highly dodgy country, which you can imagine sitting there as Adolf Hitler was preparing his... your hands and watching the money roll in, because actually the Second World War swirled around Switzerland without touching it, incredibly. But anyway, that's where they are, the World Economic Forum, this weekend. Now, one of the things that they've released beforehand is looking at what they call their Global Risks Report. And quickly moving up the scale is, you know, there's things like cyber terrorism. At the moment, what they're saying for 2023 is the energy crisis is number one, the cost of living, rising inflation, food crisis, and cyber attack. That's what they're talking about for 2023. If we move along to 2025, in a couple of years' time, the cost of living is still there. Natural disasters apparently are going to be increasing. Geopolitical conflict. Number four is climate change. And number five is social unrest. I would have thought social unrest might be quite near the top. But the most interesting, in a way, is their forecast for 2033. The number one risk, they say, is the failure to decarbonize. The number two risk is the failure to adapt to climate change. And number three there is extreme weather. Biodiversity loss, they talk about, and large-scale forced migration. Well, they're painting a picture of a totally chaotic planet by 2033. What do you make of these people at the World Economic Forum, and can we trust their risks?
No. Well, they are evil. They have a agenda which is different from serving humanity. It's about destroying humanity, world depopulation, and so forth. I think very specifically, it's interesting.
They're actually warning about this. They're saying, actually, look, you know, we're going to be looking at large-scale forced migration. This is forced migration, which means...
Well, they're starting wars everywhere and killing people by the forced injections.
Well,
or the brainwashing, promoted injections, let's call them.
Yeah, so one of the things that's quite clear after 2030, which is going shooting up the list, is this failure to decarbonise.
I think we should look at that more closely. You see, we know from our long-range forecast and changes of solar activity that the period 2030 to 2035 will be extraordinarily cold in temperate zones, and that is because of changes in solar activity and its lunar modulation. Now, they probably know this because they know our forecasts work and their own forecasts don't work. So they prepare everything knowing what is going to happen. So to talk simultaneously about runaway warming or whatever is insane. I mean, for a start, of course, the CO2 doesn't control climate. It's the other way around. But there will be catastrophes then, but they'll be caused by a cold world. There will be food shortages because of the reduction of growing zones, and we already have the reduction of wheat growing in North America, for example. The failure to combat CO2, well, I would want more CO2, not less. The reason why they talk about this now, I think, is to brainwash people into thinking that CO2 is a vital thing to reduce, and that enables them to implement all sorts of controls. And I think this stuff right now about zoning cities, although it's not immediate, they're talking about it a lot, and they say it's to save the planet. Well, really, it's an excuse for having an ideological attack on everybody to get them ready to accept any measures in the name of saving the planet for CO2, which will be all sorts of lockdowns, of course, and energy crises and so on, all of which have been deliberately created by them.
So that's someone who's not being invited to speak up at Davos this weekend. Martin, Piers is painting a picture there of, well, he doesn't use the word privatisation, but I will, of the UN, and there is a hostile takeover, a bid by the World Economic Forum for the UN a couple of years ago. Since they're running out of money and the WEF are very much awash with money, he seems to be suggesting that they are both offering the solution and causing the problem at the same time.
Well, I think the common ground between me and Piers Corbyn is that the World Economic Forum is a truly evil organisation with evil purposes.
What are those purposes?
They want to dominate the planet. They want to smash the independence of China and Russia and
they
the
can't,
Iran.
Surely this is a pie in the sky.
It is pie in the sky because the thing is that as Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until you get a punch in the mouth.
So are they prepared to go down trying at UEFA?
Well, this is the real danger. I think the real danger is that the West, because they're going to lose the war in the Ukraine, which could lead to the US dollar losing its world reserve status, they are prepared to go to nuclear war to prevent that. Or we may just end up with a nuclear war by accident, as we nearly did in 1963 and 1983 and probably several other times since. People who are worried about climate change are seriously not taking the real dangers of nuclear war seriously. When I was young, we used to worry about being blown up. Teenagers today are worried about climate change. The real danger is not that there's going to be a totalitarian state either.
Does it not matter?
The danger is
Martin,
going to be chaotic
does it not
civil
if
war.
The butterflies go extinct.
It does matter, but it's not the only thing, and it's not the most important thing. It's quite clear when they talk about, you know, climate. The real danger is a collapse, is nuclear war and a collapse of the financial system leading to endemic civil war.
We've heard from Scott Ritter there, and from a lot of our experience, that the West's military capability is not up to scratch. So I don't think the West do want to have a war, really.
Well, listen. The thing is that people do stupid stuff even when they haven't got the kit to do it. You know, they just do stupid stuff. On climate change, I'll say this. All countries are manoeuvring to take over the Arctic because the Arctic is, at the moment, losing ice to the extent that there's lots and lots of raw materials available to people. The Russians are developing icebreakers because they're going to try and control the whole northern coast of Russia, which is massive. Because there's all sorts of stuff in
pneumatic drill,
there.
You can go down and you can get to pretty much anything you want.
It's the case is that every major power surrounding the Arctic knows that there's loads of things to grab in there. That's one of the reasons why Sweden and Finland are being pushed into NATO, because that means NATO then have access to that Arctic region.
You can be sure that people like Seismograph Services and the oil companies have done their seismic surveys to see where the oil is under the Arctic or the Antarctic.
Yes, but there's a race for the Arctic going on. Now, if these people didn't believe in climate change or climate change was a hoax, why would they be preparing for a race
to the
Arctic?
They're trying to say we don't want any oil, and yet you and I know to win a war, you need oil.
Well, exactly, and there's plenty of oil in the Arctic, and it's accessible now because of climate change. That's the big thing question. Even if climate change is a thing, which I'm open to argument about it, what the World Economic Forum are talking about, carbon trading, is an absolute no-no. And I think back to when all this kicked off years ago, when Aubrey Meyer was pushing it in the NGO community. They started to push the idea that what we need is carbon trading and carbon offsets. And to their great credit, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, Oxfam, War and Want, and all the major NGOs, poverty NGOs and environmental NGOs were not interested in carbon trading.
But back in 2000, they are now.
If you want to reduce...
That's 23
carbon,
years ago, Martin.
It's a legitimate thing to want to do to reduce the use of oil and gas anyway. Because you don't want to destroy the environment to produce oil and gas. We should have been producing energy-efficient cars from 1973 onwards.
One of the things I repeat
time
and time again...
But that doesn't mean carbon trading, it means planning.
This relates to these rail strikes, for example, is that when we were growing up, it was incredibly dirt cheap, peanuts to go around on public transport, pennies to get a bus. They were regular, they were pretty efficient, really. The trains also in public ownership, no shareholders, no fat cat bosses, and people didn't need a car.
That's right. And I think there's common ground between those who are concerned about climate change and those who don't think it's a thing. We need to use less resources and achieve better results anyway. But it can't be done through market mechanisms, through creating a market in carbon. If you want to reduce oil, gas and coal use, you have to make a plan like you did in World War II. And you have to discuss it with everybody, and the market won't do it. And this is the problem for the World Economic Forum. Every problem that they're trying to solve has to be solved by the market.
I think the Chinese,
the market won't solve
Martin,
that problem.
are too happy about being told they've got to close or down all their coal-fired power
stations.
Well,
that's right. They're saying the Russians and the Chinese are prepared to accept that there is a problem with carbon emissions or climate change. I would say it's a problem with resource over-exploitation. I mean, we used to talk about things like peak oil. And, of course, in many indigenous communities in Latin America and around the world, they don't want oil and gas exploration because it destroys their traditional way of life. So there's a very good reason for reducing oil and gas
I've just talked about a simple way to do that, public transport.
Well, exactly. So what you need is a plan. So you nationalise all transports. I mean, in Tallinn in Estonia, who are on the wrong side of the Russian crisis, public transport in Tallinn is free. Why can't we do that? Just make public transport free. And, of course, the private sector's got no role in free public transport. If you're going to have free public transport, it's got to be provided by the public sector because there's no money to be made.
OK, well, now we've put the world to rights, one could be forgiven for thinking that the Lords of Chaos are in charge. So let's, on the Friday the 13th of January 2023, ask David Livingstone who these Knights Templar were, because the Friday the 13th of October... 1307 was the exact date when the Templars were arrested. Well, both David and I would say actually the Templars were not Christians. They were supposedly a part of the Vatican. They'd convinced the Vatican that they were great guys. But no, they were a satanic group and they were exposed. So let's have a listen now to David Livingstone talking about the Knights Templar and their role in the occult through history.
Some people don't like the word the occult, and the reality is that we often say occultism, which is it's a convenient way of avoiding saying Satanism. You know, not all cult is satanic, but and not all Satanism is a cult. But in this case, what we are talking about is satanic occultism. So it goes back to Babylon in the 6th century BC, the development of a tradition that merged the worship of underworld gods with the Babylon history of magic and astrology. And so this is basically what came to be in the Jewish tradition came to be known as Kabbalah. It's basically it's a heresy of Judaism. And so it's, you know, the early practitioners would present themselves to the world as merely being an interpretation of Judaism, basically as a way of disguising their apostasy from Judaism. And what it's based on is the idea that Solomon had learned magic somehow from, you know, basically some kind of discarded entities, demonic entities of some sort, and that he used that power to build, first of all, that he had a sigil, or, you know, the Star of David, or the Star of Solomon, was a six-pointed star, which he used as a seal to on a ring, apparently, to control these demons. And then he used his control over these demons to build the temple of Solomon. So there is a legitimate Orthodox tradition in Judaism that looks forward to the rebuilding of the temple as, you know, part of fulfillment of Bible prophecy with the return of the Messiah. And there's a parallel satanic tradition, occult Kabbalistic tradition, that also aspires to rebuilding of the third temple, but their Messiah is the Antichrist. So that's why when you look at a group like the Knights Templar, for example, which is really where modern Western occultism begins. They are founded again on the idea of this reconstruction of the temple. And so this is how their place in history was appropriated by the Freemasons, who continued this concept of rebuilding of the temple. So they're called Masons, or bricklayers, because supposedly they are laying the bricks for the foundations of effectively a new world order, which is to be governed by the expected Messiah, who is going to, so they're, and they're laying the bricks, sorry, they're laying the bricks for the rebuilding of the Temple of Solomon, the third temple. And so, as I said, this is understood to them to be a fulfillment of Bible prophecy. There's a, you know, the rebuilding of the temple is, you know, central to Jewish expectation, but it's also found, of course, in the book of Revelation, which turns out to be effectively used as a template for them to follow. And this is according to Albert Pike, who wrote Morals and Dogma. He's the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, wrote the Morals and Dogma, which served very much as a kind of Bible of Freemasonry. And he explains that the Book of Revelation is a Kabbalistic book, a coded book. And so effectively, it outlines the plan that they are to follow. So they want to actively work towards fulfilling Bible prophecy, which is why they are, you know, by analogy, reconstructing the third temple. What they're doing is rebuilding the third temple. And to
that is interesting. Hang on, though, because I mean, I don't know if Albert Pike's been reading Revelation correctly, or maybe he's been inventing bits of it. But the culmination of the book is a description of the New Jerusalem descending from heaven. And it actually specifically says in there that there's no temple within it, that the actual presence of God is just the light of God throughout the city, and that it actually says in Revelation there is no temple within, you know. So there's something specifically kind of running counter to what Pike is saying.
Well, I mean, it's a Luciferian tradition, which is, you know, surprisingly taking the same prophecies, but again, you know, siding with the opposite camp. So they're siding with the camp of the Antichrist because they believe that they are at war with God, who is unjust.
Anyway, can you say something about the Templars? Because I know that there were, back in medieval times, there were several crusades. It was something which was launched from Rome, you know, as opposed to Constantinople, because there were two separate churches, as there still are, the Eastern Church and the Western Church. And I think it was the second or third crusade ended up with an absolutely horrific massacre in Constantinople, very, very convenient for the Pope, of the Orthodox Church, and in fact almost all, I think, the residents of Constantinople were slaughtered. This was the Templars that were responsible for this. They're obviously an interesting crew. One of the basic things about them is they were kind of French based. They had bases in Britain, of which Bristol was one. They had Edinburgh too, and London, the famous Temple Church in London, which is now the centre for the legal profession, or much of the legal profession. The other thing is that they had a immunity from the law because they were sanctioned by the Catholic Church, and they didn't have to sort of obey really the laws of the individual lands that they were in, which is obviously quite handy, putting them above the law. So who were they?
So the Templars, first of all, we have to understand, you know, who led the First Crusade. So the First Crusade is called the Prince's Crusade. It had a number of leaders. The most famous one is Godfrey of Bouillon. And so all these, basically they belong to a group of families that were leaders of French and British aristocracy. And so what I saw in my book is how interrelated all these families are. And, you know, I'm not going to name all the details, but, you know, one important group, one important locus is what's called the Abbey of Cluny in France. And it was founded by a William of Aquitaine. He was a grandson. So there's a lot of legends that surround this. And so it's hard to know exactly what's true. But apparently this William of Aquitaine was the grandson of a Guillaume of Cologne, who's famous in the French early medieval romances. And so the legend is that he was the son of a Rabbi Makir, who was sent in exile from Babylon. So the Jewish community in the Islamic world were ruled by a figure, political figure, known as an exilarch, who claimed descent from David. So it was a hereditary title, because, as you know, the Messiah is supposed to descend from David, be the son of David. So there's a dispute, and so the one who lost the appointment to the title basically found his way to the West and to France. So that's how he basically, there's a book, it's called Sefer HaKabbalah, which explains that he basically became interrelated, quote unquote, with the family of Charlemagne. And this is how supposedly, you know, they gave birth to this Guillaume of Cologne. So when you look at the families involved in the First Crusade, they're all intricately related with each other and can all trace their descent back to this Guillaume of Cologne. And why that's important is because they appear to have prized their sort of Davidic descent. So they appear to have been aware that they had this sacred bloodline that they were preserving, because they were effectively preserving the bloodline of the Messiah. When you look at all these families, again, they're all the families that are interrelated. Like, one of the important leaders of the First Crusade was Stephen of Blois. Now, I can't remember his relation, but I think he was a stepbrother of Hugh of Champagne. Hugh of Champagne was one of the founders of the Templars, and he was associated with a very important figure in Jewish history known as Rashi, and considered one of the most, you know, important figures in the history of Judaism, particularly medieval Judaism in particular. And he's also considered one of the early figures in the history of Zionism, because he claimed he was one of the first to propose that the Jews were entitled to the land of Jerusalem. So it's interesting that, you know, this early Zionist project was very closely affiliated with the Templars. And so Rashi was also was in contact with a number of Christians, in particular a guy named Stephen Hardin, who was associated with Bernard of Clairvaux, who was the patron saint. Sorry, not the patron saint, the patron of the Templars. And it's effectively through the effort of Bernard of Clairvaux that the founding of the Templars was sanctioned by the Pope. So the Templars, to make a long story short, they became enormously powerful. They are considered sort of the first international bankers. They gained so much power that apparently the Catholic Church, there's one of the reasons why the Catholic Church was concerned about them, but the other reason was because of the satanic rites that they apparently practiced. So they apparently had rituals involving sodomy and urinating on the cross and what's called the obscene kiss, which is kissing the devil in the form of a black cat on the anus. And this is a particular ritual which was very common throughout most of the circles of witchcraft at the time. It was also known amongst the Cathars, another Luciferian sect. And so the Cathars are also, you know, really central to this entire history, occult history. They figure very much in the lore of the Holy Grail. So what's interesting, of course, then is the claim is that, so Philip le Bel, Philip the Fourth, I think, of France, is the one who ordered the arrest of the Templars. So the common history you'll hear throughout basically not only just Masonic history, but most mainstream history, is they accuse him of being greedy and wanting to appropriate the wealth and power of the Templars. But the reality is that you can look at the true history of the Templars, and in particular, I'd recommend a book by Malcolm Barber, which is called The Trial of the Templars. And this is a respected academic study of the Templars, and he points out that there was a number of confessions that were obtained through torture, but there were also confessions that were obtained without torture. And even some of those confessions that were obtained through torture, the Templars who made those confessions admitted that they didn't make those confessions because of the torture. So basically you have, you know, this is one of the first early orders, because, you know, these accusations of witchcraft, this is before what they called the burning times, before witchcraft became more widespread. Again, you found them amongst groups like the Cathars, but this is one of the first early reported admissions of devil worship, you know, that were made at that time, and made in this case in one of the most politically powerful orders of the time. And that is largely the reason why, you know, in secret, the Templars were believed to have, you know, preserved some kind of secret and are revered ultimately by first the Rosicrucians and then finally the Freemasons.
So David Livingstone there. We're going to hear just another short clip in a second. But it's interesting, you know, if you do a little bit of digging, you can flesh out what he's saying. The non-tortured Templars who confessed to their horrific crimes as satanic knights pretending to be Christians, three names. One is Esquin of Floyan, Esquin of Floyan. Another was called Bernard Pelle, Bernard Pellet. Another one called Gerard, Gerard of Byzol, Byzol. So, you know, there are actually, you know, if you want to flesh this stuff out, I would obviously suggest you, you know, check out the book that David mentioned there. So finally, a short clip about today. This is why, you know, we're interested in this stuff, is what does this mean today still?
Well, I mean, you're seeing it everywhere today, right? It's in fact, I was rereading today the evolution of how Europeans, modern societies have been shaped, right? So what's important is that before the modern European politics, societies were always run by empires. Right? And the purpose of an empire is that usually it had some kind of guiding ideology or religion that it implemented in the form of a state, and that it would absorb as much territory as possible. And there were different ways that this was achieved. And you had examples like you had the Persian Empire, for example, where it was still possible for a number of different nationalities to coexist. So, you know, the Persian Empire was unique, you know, as an early example of a pluralistic empire where they allowed different religions to exist within the empire. And again, the Islamic Empire was the same, right? So what you have today is kind of a reversal where you have the existence of states. And these states are to be governed, they effectively by a sort of an artificial unifying principle, which is usually a shared tradition, a shared culture, an ethnic identity, a language. So instead of the governing ideal of the society being some kind of an ideology, it tends to be something more, let's say, more contrived and less meaningful in a sense, because this is even how you get to the point where you get the concept of race as being the basis of nationalism. So what's interesting is that the Rosicrucian movement emerged in 1618 when they try to hand over the crown of Bohemia to Frederick V of the Palatinate. Again, he is part of this same family network. And what that did is that it immediately upset the Habsburgs and began their 30 Years' War. The 30 Years' War concluded with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. And so the Peace of Westphalia is considered to have laid the foundation for the modern creation, the modern concept of sovereignty. So instead of empires, you now have these states. Because effectively, we have to understand that this is the ultimate goal of the, you know, New World Order, is to create this global federation. So this is why you have that these societies, their goal, and you can trace the history of it all. So it goes from the Peace of Westphalia, then the Congress of Vienna in 1815 after the defeat of Napoleon, which again further divided, created most of the early modern states. And then again, the revolutions of 1848, which were all conducted by underground secret societies, and again led to the formation of the states. I have an entire chapter in my book on the Carbonari, which talks about, in particular, the formation, the unification of Germany, and also the unification of Italy, again by secret societies, particularly the unification movement in Italy, which was led by Giuseppe Mazzini, who was reportedly the successor to Adam Weishaupt as head of the Illuminati. And you can see this entire network working underground within all these revolutions, all tied to various Masonic traditions that are working towards the formation of these states, because ultimately you can see how these states continue to concretize in the 20th century. And ultimately, you know, one of the main accomplishments of the 20th century was first the creation of League of Nations, which was effectively a failure, but ultimately the United Nations, which is the beginning of this step of towards achieving this federation. Because we have to understand that, again, the goal of these secret societies is to work towards the establishment of a world kingdom to be governed by the Messiah. So they've done their homework, and it seems to be that they've interpreted that he is going to have to be somehow the leader of a global state. And it appears to be that the most effective means of establishing a global state is dividing the world into various nation states. And this is effectively how they created, you know, the concept of nationalism, to create pockets throughout the world where people could appropriate this false identity to claim now that they are members of a particular nation. And so that, yeah, ultimately now you have the world divided in all these multiple states. And, you know, if the I'm not sure if the United Nations is going to play that role, or some organizations was going to be born out of it. But ultimately, again, you know, the goal is this kind of World Federation, which is to be governed in the end by who they believe them is the Messiah, but ultimately is effectively the Antichrist.
Well, how fascinating. That's David Livingston speaking to me this week from Canada. And his website, audoabko.ca, has got his book on there, which really just takes you through the history of this satanic organization over not just the centuries, the millennia. I think he's done a fantastic job joining the dots. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Joe Banks, local freelance journalist, and we'll hope to get him back in a few weeks' time, whether we have the results of our Hot Wells and Harbourside by-election. We've also been in the presence of sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll find this podcast, the full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. The live stream is on radioqeuk.com and also at talkradio.org.uk here. Plus, my books are out there at bilderberg.org. If anyone's blocking you going to that site, as a lot of the new browsers, if you keep updating obsessively your browser, you'll find they do try and block you. Do see if you can find a way and email me, and maybe we can help you to unblock the block to the Bilderberg website. I noticed I was in the Costa Coffee the other day, and they don't let you look at Bilderberg. No, you're not allowed to look at the Bilderberg website, but the books are there, either free with a watermark in them and degraded photos, or you can get the ebooks, download the ebooks, or you can buy paperback copies. I haven't sold very many, but there you go. That's because I'm not a mass marketed person, but they're very reasonable, and it's just basically covering my costs, the cost of those. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at talkradio.org.uk and on the app at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, particularly for Pat Hart this week, and don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.